welcome to the February 15th edition of Dead Pit Radio. I'm the Creepy Kentucky.
And I'm Uncle Bill. What's going on?
Oh, a whole lot of stuff going on this week. We actually have a special two-part interview, which begins this week with Wicked Pixel Cinema's Eric Stanzi.
The Stanzi!
He's directed such films as Scrapbook,
Deadwood Park,
and Savage Harvest, which was one of his first big films. Actually, a pretty big independent film for 1994-95, in that era. But we're going to have him on the show in a little bit. Again, it's part one of two parts, and we definitely want to urge everyone to go and check out his films. He has some great independent films.
Yeah, so the thing about the Stanzi, as I like to call him now since I've actually had a chance to talk with him, I think I can call him the Stanzi now, is that he is, in my opinion, probably one of the best, if not the best, independent film directors going today. And he's also a writer and other stuff, too.
Yeah.
A lot of people who make independent films should really take note of this guy, because I think he's got a really unique style and a really great way of putting together films that would seemingly, you wouldn't see one director do different types of this kind of these type of films, but he does them all and does them all very well, too.
Indeed. And we're actually not going to have the call-in portion this week due to the Valentine's Day holiday, which that'll we'll actually have a pretty cool call-in topic, hopefully, next week's show that we'll let everyone know about by the MySpace show on myspace.com/deadpitradio for all those out there that aren't hit to the MySpace goodness. We actually do another separate show,
buddy,
exclusively for MySpace.
We do all kinds of shit. We do stuff on YouTube. We got stuff on eBay right now on auction. We do stuff on MySpace. We're the multifaceted community of shit.
Community of horror goodness. Yeah. So, also, though, we're talking about films this week. I don't know. We can never take a break from talking about films.
I'd like to take a break from talking about this
shit. I want to, actually.
So, we actually have the sequel to a movie that I didn't even know existed, Punk Rock Holocaust 2, which is directed by Doug Sackman. And for folks that don't really know about this, this is shot on the Vans Warped Tour, which, you know, I don't really know exactly any of the bands involved in that, but we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. And then we've got this little ditty here from our good buddy over at J.J. Conley. Is the name of the guy.
Oh, there, okay.
No, he's not actually from J.J. Conley. His name's J.J. Conley. J.J.! This is called Goth Kill the Soul Collector.
Oh.
Yeah.
We actually have a Blu-ray disc to talk about. It's one of the, I think it's the first Blu-ray DVD we've ever reviewed on Dead Pit on the show.
I believe it is, yeah.
It's directed by Junho Bong. That's his name. It is The Host. It's Korea's number one selling film, horror film of all time.
The Host!
Anyway, I just noticed that this Goth Kill movie stars a woman by the name of Eve Blackwater, which got me thinking about that song. Eve Blackwater, keep on rolling, Mississippi, won't you keep on shining on me?
Ship.
I hate that song. Eve Blackwater. Anyway, the other movie we got is Can't Stop the Rock, which is from Marquee Motion Pictures. It is, it's not really a documentary. It's more like just a sit-down conversation, like a shoot interview that a guy has in a hotel room with this guy by the name of Dave Nelson, I believe is his name.
Dave the Rock Nelson,
yeah.
Get
who, we'll talk more about him because the film is really mostly all about his life anyway, so we'll talk about that during the review.
We have a new independent semi-feature film, I guess. It's like 46 minutes long, entitled Hatchet Jack. And I look forward to talking about that one.
Hatchet Jack, we'll cut off your fucking head now.
Hatchet Jack, man.
So, we might as well get into the horror news. There's actually a pretty good amount of horror news, at least, you know, some very informative news.
Mm-hmm. So, horror news you can use. So, you want to go ahead, or you want me to, or what?
Let's go ahead and talk about the Fear Itself directors. Seven of the directors have been chosen in Mick Garris' TV series, Fear Itself, which is a new horror anthology airing on NBC, similar to the Masters of Horror series, which aired on Showtime. It will feature 60-minute films by some of Hollywood's big-name horror writers and directors, including Stuart Gordon of Reanimator and From Beyond, Brad Anderson from Session 9 and The Machinist, Mary Harron from American Psycho, Breck Eisner from the upcoming Crazies remake.
What the hell's that?
Yeah, I don't know. Ronnie Yu of Freddy vs. Jason, and that's...
I hate that guy.
Yeah.
I think we talked about that.
That's a shame.
I don't like a single damn movie that guy's ever done.
Yeah, it's a shame that they put him on this, because he does, to me, he doesn't understand horror. Ernest Dickerson of Demon Knight and John Carpenter of Halloween and The Thing, among many others. So those are the big directors so far. Yeah, I don't understand why three or four of these guys are on here. Ronnie Yu's the big one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I kind of like the idea of getting somebody like Mary Harron, because she's one of the only people I know that's female that directed a contemporary horror film, and so I'm all for that. But yeah, Ronnie Yu shit, I just don't like his style, like really fast editing, and it's mostly like Michael Bay style. It's kind of the same way, but he just on a smaller level puts it to horror movies.
You know, interesting thing though, that a lot of people may not know. I don't know how big of a following this movie has, but the Rage Carrie 2 is actually directed by a female director too. I think her name is Kat Shea.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty underrated movie, I think. I always thought that was pretty decent, you know, modern.
I don't remember that movie at all. I know I saw it because I think it was on television, but I don't remember.
Yeah,
I
that's just one of the movies. I don't know. A lot of people don't talk about it, but she was another one. I think she did a pretty good job directing that movie. It's like, really is a remake of Carrie, I guess, but, you know, it's decent.
I've actually heard, though, speaking of the Fear Itself series, that it's rumored that Tobe Hooper is going to be doing one, and Greg Nicotero is actually going to be directing one, too.
Greggy. So we can look forward to Fear Itself when it comes on NBC. Hopefully it'll last more than one season like a lot of the stuff on NBC.
Yeah. Here's probably the most interesting story to me that I've heard this week, and it's about the Giallo film from Dario Argento. And according to a news story in the New York Daily News, so you know it's accurate, Vincent Gallo is...
Vinny.
He's departing from the film Giallo because... At one time, he was married.
He was boning.
To Aggie Argento.
So Aggie.
He says, and this is his quote, by the way, after they cast Aggie Argento, I've been trying to get out of it. I'd rather not be in a movie with her. I'm not a fan. I was a fan of her father's. I'm retiring. So I'm assuming that their split was probably not very amicable, because anybody that wants to get off a movie because one another person's in it, you got to imagine they hate each other.
Indeed.
Yeah, so he's probably out, and she's in, and quite frankly, like, I'd rather have her in a film than Vincent Gallo. That's just me. Like, I don't care if she's the biggest
bitch
of all time.
Vincent Gallo's the asshole. I mean, Asia's freaking awesome. All shit, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
More news on The Lost Boys 2, The Tribe. Corey Haim will indeed appear in the Warner Brothers Pictures direct-to-TV or DVD sequel, The Lost Boys 2, The Tribe. And all the scenes excised from the script involving the Sam Emerson character are being reintroduced to the film. So I guess they're being reshot. So that'll make it more. And, you know.
Good for him. Good for Corey Haim putting down the mescaline and the PCP for a minute to make a film.
Yeah, more than that, though. I mean, it actually does make sense to have Corey Haim in the movie. Because
I think it made sense before, but he's a retard. Like, he won't.
Yeah.
I know they said it was his visa, but I'm sure it had something to do with drugs.
It was more with his pills instead of his visa.
Yeah. It's with his Vicodin. Let's see what else we got here. Old Bruce Dickinson, buddy. The guy's awesome.
Brucey.
He's not only a pilot and a certified fencing master.
An asshole.
And dickhead, yeah. He's also the lead singer of Iron Maiden, which is actually the best thing that he's ever done and probably ever will do. But it reportedly... Warner Music will make Chemical Wedding its first theatrical motion picture release, distributing the film in Britain. It's directed by Julian Doyle, the movie star Simon Callow, as a professor who becomes the reincarnation of the notorious occultist Aleister Crowley. And the thing to note about this movie is that the script was actually written by frontman Bruce Dickinson, whose involvement was key to the Warner Music decision to acquire the film. The company will sneak preview Chemical Wedding at the Cannes Film Festival, and a U.S. distributor has not yet been found.
I love Bruce Dickinson. I love his music and stuff, but he's a dickhead. Everybody knows that. Everybody's ever met him.
Just ask Ozzy.
So up next is Dark Sky Films and Glass Eye Pictures are partnering up for a film entitled The House of the Devil. It's a horror thriller from writer-director Ty West, who also directed the Cabin Fever sequel, which I have no idea what the hell's happened with that.
Me either.
And the film deals with a young woman who takes on more than she bargained for in a babysitting job. Production is set to begin in Connecticut in mid-March, with casting now underway.
Oh, my God.
Yes!
Ty West has got it directed The Roost, which I haven't seen, but I always hear people talking about
it. I always get Ty West confused with that douchebag that's the carpenter on those TV shows. What was his name? Ty something.
Ty Carpenter?
Ty Outlaw.
Oh, yeah. Ty Outlaw.
Is that his name?
Sure. Bo Outlaw. I know he plays for, I think he plays for the Grizzlies now.
No,
but anyway, Rob Zombie's next film. We're going to be talking a little bit about that because it's a pretty interesting choice, I guess, that he decided not to do another remake, which was rumored for a long time that he was going to do another remake of a film. He might actually do a sequel of Halloween, the Halloween remake, but thank God he's not doing that.
Mm.
But apparently it's been reported that coming August 28th, 2009, is something called Rob Zombie's Tyrannosaurus Rex. It's the same end of the year summer slot that paid off for the Halloween. We have no idea what the movie is about yet, apparently. Soon after, Rob Zombie himself on his blog said, "I will tell you that it has nothing to do with dinosaurs."
Oh.
That's interesting.
Maybe it's a serial killer called Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Mm-hmm. Could be. It's like a big sumbitch serial killer with little arms.
Yeah. You know, I think we've been a little hard on Rob Zombie. I mean, I know we didn't like,
I don't.
We didn't like his Halloween envisioning or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I really do think the guy does have some sort of writing ability and filming ability for these movies. I mean, say what you want to about if you like the movie or not, but each of his movies does have a distinct look, and you can tell that it's a Rob Zombie movie.
Tell you what I think. Rob Zombie needs to buy a program that whenever he writes a script, it automatically deletes the words fuck and shit out of it. And then he might
the script
be able,
wouldn't be like, it'd be two pages.
Yeah. If he could buy like something like that, like a program that would do that, he'd be fine. Other than that, I don't want to see anything else. My God.
Oh, fuck my baby.
I swear.
What else you got over there?
Well, I think we probably should take a break. And we'll get into some more horror news, and we'll have the feature interview with Eric Stanzi here in a few minutes on the original Horror Talk Radio Show. And never forget that, folks, deadpitch.com.
We're original.
Join us for the 4th annual Sean Liu Horror Fest benefit for the American Cancer Society on Saturday, June 14th. Featuring several local bands in 5 films on 35mm and digital projection, including Reanimator, The Holy Mountain, Salo the 120 Days of Sodom, and the upstate New York premiere of the uncut restored Grindhouse print of Cannibal Holocaust. The Sean Liu Horror Fest on Saturday, June 14th at the Palace Theater in Syracuse. For more information, visit myspace.com/Jeffrey_Meyer.
And you're rocking out and listening to Dead Pit Radio.
Welcome back, folks, to the best horror talk radio show in existence known to man today.
It's the Dead Pit.
And, of course, we're in the middle of the news section here. We're trying to get through all the current news topics and the news you can use, so let's go ahead and get back into it real quick. Let's talk about George A. Romero for a minute because a lot of people who listen to the show realize he's my favorite overall horror director. He's got my favorite horror film of all time.
He's your favorite guy.
He's my favorite gentleman. Just in general, in any kind of format. Apparently, I know a lot of people might remember this from back in the Land of the Dead years.
You got your legs spread for George.
I do. I'm going to smear
come
peanut
on,
butter
George,
on my ass.
Give it to me, baby.
I'd take one for the team for George Romero. I mean, fuck, the guy gave us three movies, three of the best horror movies of all time.
That's the first, folks. The guy loves George Romero so much he'd get butt fucked by him.
If it meant Dawn of the Dead would never get made unless George Romero butt fucked me, I'd take a butt fucking. That's the best movie ever made. Anyway, you might remember, I'm sure people love the lead into this story, that around the time Land of the Dead was getting to come out, there was this other really weird project called Diamond Dead that a lot of people thought would be the film that Romero would direct. And I remember the synopsis was so bizarre that people thought that it would never really happen. But apparently, there's a couple of websites that have talked to Romero about it, and it's back on, which is amazing, considering like he's supposed to be doing the sequel to Diary of the Dead. And, you know, there's all kinds of other stuff planned.
Prequel to Land of the Dead.
So here's what it says, though. Said, I got a phone call 2 days ago before I came out here. This is Romero talking from the producer. From the producer saying, we're back. Since the budget is being put together as we speak, nothing further is known, but it's pretty cool nonetheless. And now the Diamond Dead story is the one where there's a female singer who tries to join up with an up-and-coming garage band only to be the cause of their death. She makes a deal with Death himself to bring them back as a zombie rock band, and they all become immediately famous.
That sounds fucking killer.
So apparently, yeah, Romero will get a chance to do Diamond Dead. I love movies like that, though. I can't even like lie about that at all.
Yeah, that
like
sounds,
movies like
it sounds like Black Roses.
Black Roses, yeah, I was going to say, or you know, even movies like Rock and Roll Nightmare. I love.
It's a rock and roll nightmare, alone again. I want to talk about Sam Raimi's first post-Spider-Man film, Drag Me to Hell. It seems that Ellen Page, the star of Juno and Hard Candy, has been signed on to star in the film. Now, the film is described as a morality tale about the unwitting recipient of a supernatural curse. Sam Raimi wrote the project with his brother, Ivan, and Sam's Ghost House Pictures Company.
Dick House Pictures.
Yeah, it is. It's slated to begin principal photography in Los Angeles on March the 17th, so that's definitely a project you want to look forward to. And Sam Raimi, I'm just amazed that he's actually going back into the horror genre. I think that's a big thing, actually.
This absolutely doesn't surprise me at all, because I figured if Sam Raimi was going to go back and do a film like this, it would be completely different than the films he's most, you know, known for. He's going to get, like, the probably single biggest female star, hottest female star going right now as far as, you know, she's got all kinds of awesome
Juno.
Clothes.
You're a big fan of Juno.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen Juno yet, but I love the principle of some preteen-looking whore getting knocked up. It's great. Who wouldn't love that?
Well, especially here in Eastern Kentucky.
Yeah, that's like a rite of passage. You
know, that's why the movie, actually, I don't know if people know this, but the limited theatrical run that it had here in Eastern Kentucky, every theater sold out, and it sold out in advance for Juno.
Yeah, people thought it was like a biopic of a holler around here.
Yeah.
Because there's a holler called Juno Holler. That's up on Buck's Branch.
Right, it's right next to Zelda.
Yeah. But anyway, a couple of remake stories here, of course. We have to have at least five. That's a prerequisite amount of remake stories you can have on one show anymore. Last House on the Left Redux has apparently been picked up by Rogue Pictures with Wes Craven producing. And there's another remake and another Craven movie they're going to be doing, too. The company has also picked up the rights to the new version of George A. Romero's The Crazies.
Yay.
Previously been in development at Paramount with Brad Anderson attached. I guess that got scrapped. I remember reading that story a while back, though. I think The Craven Project, though, which is the first film that he'll actually write and direct since probably Wes Craven's New Nightmare, is called 25-8. Which revolves around a serial killer who resurrects 15 years after the night of his own demise, intent on murdering 17s who were born at the same time. And I guess he says it's more a thriller than a slasher film and revolves around a young kid with a very dark past involving his family and his father.
Huh.
Good God.
That sounds great.
You ever notice when these directors get a little bit older, they tend to stray away from films like that? They always want everything to be called a thriller or a psychological drama or something.
It's a psychological thriller.
I just don't understand.
More remakes. Friday the 13th remake. And this actually, special thanks go out to BloodDisgusting.com for breaking this news. It was a big scoop. They received word that Platinum Dunes remake of Friday the 13th is going to start shooting on April 21st in Austin, Texas. Now, no casting has been announced yet, but expect some updates very soon. And the current plan is to have this film out by February 13th, 2009, which is Friday the 13th. Now, the remake is directed by Marcus Nispel of the wonderful film Texas Chainsaw Massacre from 2003.
Bridget.
And we'll focus on Jason Voorhees, who will wear the mask and kill and keep the famous setting at Camp Crystal Lake. So, okay. Marcus Nispel, we'll see how much talent this guy has when I would say a good 90% of people in the independent world could make that movie and probably make it better than him.
I would guarantee that you could probably find a cat that's been hit by a tack hammer that can make a Friday the 13th film entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, a movie that's that basic is pretty much a can't miss.
But see,
so we'll see.
We thought, that, this is what I keep trying to tell people, we thought the same thing, and especially I did too, about Halloween when that fucking movie came out. And look what happened to that.
That's true.
It's a pretty basic concept, but people have a tendency to want to get really overboard with the, you know, camera work and the artsiness of it and just absolutely...
Backstory.
Yeah, especially the backstory. That's another thing Nispel's really bad for if you watch those Texas Chainsaw movies.
Yeah.
That shit on that guy.
I just don't understand. I mean, a lot of people, and I guess people just, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know what the hell's wrong with people.
I don't either. In general, I don't know.
Yeah. Because, okay, I know that Daniel Pearl was the same cinematographer for the original Texas Chainsaw, but like, I'll admit, I've never seen that movie since, like, 2003, since we watched it in theaters. But to me, I didn't get anything. I didn't see any difference, like, in the cinematography. Did you? Do you remember anything? Like, the artistic value of the movie? I don't.
In what?
Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake.
Buddy, there wasn't nothing artistic about that fucking movie. Like, seriously. Okay, I'll give the guy this. I think... that aside from Saw, that movie is directly responsible for that, the horrible, grainy, washed out look that all remakes have nowadays. And it doesn't matter what it is. Like, you can, I guarantee you that some of those films, like the Prom Night remake, will have that same look. Like, it seems to me like if anybody has a horror remake out there, they want it to look like that because that's the way of letting you know that it's a redux or something. Right. That it's retro.
Well, I mean, I know that, and I was talking to our buddy Kelly Marquardt about, how awesome, Daniel Pearl is as far as cinematography goes and stuff. And I was flat out honest, I couldn't remember, as far as just the look of it, but I couldn't remember any fantastic shots in it. I know Daniel Pearl's a music video cinematographer, director now, and maybe that's why I didn't like it. It looked way modern, way too modern for me. And but besides the look of it, I mean, it was a horrible movie. It was just pissing on a classic in my eyes.
Yeah, I don't think you could ever get either one of us to admit anything that movie was worth a damn.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably be willing to watch it again if somebody drugged me, but, you know, other than that, I don't know if I'll ever watch it again.
Yeah, it'd have to be like a coked-out Andrew Bernarski. He'd have to kidnap me and make me watch it.
Yeah, to me, I mean, like I said, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original, is an all-time classic. It's a movie that can't be remade.
It's kind of like they're trying to remake Last House on the Left and stuff.
Yeah.
The films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Last House on the Left pretty much exist in the time that they were made. You can't really remake that. It's like trying to capture lightning in a bottle.
Yeah, and it makes you hate it even more when you see, you know, the younger 15, 16, 17-year-old kids think that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that fucking movie from 5 years ago. Like, they don't even know what the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre was. That's the thing that really ticks me off about a lot of this stuff.
Well, it also takes away from the fact that how revolutionary the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre was, too.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure these kids, they probably wouldn't even think that was scary. Because it's been done 1,000 times now, that style of movie and stuff. But back at that time, I don't think anybody had ever seen anything like that.
Yeah. So, Marcus Nispel's a piece of shit. Most of the movies.
Yeah.
Well.
To sum up.
Yeah. He's a piece of shit. Odds are that Friday the 13th remake's going to be a piece of shit. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I'm sorry, Kelly. It's a piece of shit. The one from 2003.
Okay.
Piece of shit.
Let's talk about something that hopefully will not be a piece of shit, though, is the After Dark Films Frontiers movie, which I heard a lot about, and I'm hoping that eventually to get a chance to see it, but it's a French gore fest. It's been moved.
It's a frog.
Yeah. Apparently, it's been moved from May 2nd to May 9th after It has been revealed that the DVD will also hit the shelves four days later on May the 13th from Lionsgate. Courtney Solomon, who is the director of the film, says, Xavier created a film that's challenging and provocative. No, I'm sorry. Courtney Solomon is the After Dark CEO, who was talking about the guy who directed the film. Says, Xavier created a film that's challenging and provocative with an emotional impact that horror films don't always deliver. Given this, we wanted to offer audiences the chance to see it, both on a large screen in the theater as well as in the comfort of their homes. We also wanted to present the film in a way that Xavier imagined it, which is uncut, unedited, and unaltered in any way to comply with a specific rating. This is a prime example of the type of film we will continue to deliver, a great horror flick that delves far deeper than most films of this genre.
Well, hopefully After Dark Film can actually deliver a movie that's good for once.
Yeah, I mean, the uncut version of Captivity lends so much more to the film.
You know, I hate to say that, but the truth of the matter is, I would say at least 98% of all After Dark films are horrible, you know.
What's the 2%? Would that be Nightmare Man?
Yeah, Nightmare Man and Tooth and Nail, since, you know, that was Dawkins' song.
Also, though, what was the ghost movie that Mike Mendez did?
Oh,
that wasn't that bad.
The Cemetery.
No, it was like Ghost Talkers.
Ghost Whisperer.
What the hell was that movie?
Hell, I don't know.
You don't remember the Mike Mendez movie we watched?
Buddy, I don't remember shit I watched last week.
Grave Dancers, that was
it.
Oh,
okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Motel Hell remake, though, originally slated for October 31st release by MGM. The studio recently sold the rights to Motel Hell to Twisted Pictures, the same people behind the Saw movies. It isn't clear what they'll be doing with the film, but we're told they're going to turn it into a brand new original franchise. Now, we all remember the classic original film, which Farmer Vincent kidnaps unsuspecting travelers and is burying them in his garden. Unfortunately for his victims, they are not dead. He feeds his victims to prepare them for his roadside stand. His motto is, it takes all kinds of critters to make Farmer Vincent's fritters.
It's another movie I have no earthly idea why they're trying to remake. But whatever.
Well, it does have a pretty cool name, I guess.
It's obviously...
If you wanted to buy the movie and just use the name, which they're doing a lot lately, it seems like.
No, it's gotten to the point now where it's like, it's pointless to argue about why they do these remakes and stuff, because they're going to remake everything anyway. You might as well just get used to it. But sometimes something comes along and just baffles the mind why the hell they would want to remake it. Like,
yeah,
Chud.
I actually, Motel Hell is not really even that good of a movie, honestly.
No,
I mean, it's okay, but it's like... It's in with a lot of the movies that came out around that time. It's just pretty much a forgettable movie, and not a lot of people even know what the hell it is. So I don't really understand what they're doing there, unless what I think they're going to do is just use the name and create an entirely new concept around the name, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's on the slate of all the 80 movies that'll be remade anyway. Real quick, Mitchell Lichtenstein's horror comedy Teeth, which probably had one of the best premises for a film. There was actually an Asian horror film called Killer Pussy. I'm not kidding. It was called something else, too, but it was called Killer Pussy. Like, that was the title. It's kind of similar to this, but this movie, Teeth, starring Jess Wexler and John Hensley, is arriving on DVD May the 6th. I'm pretty sure it's a story of a woman who's got teeth in her vagina.
Oh, God.
That's all you really need to know about it. And that's all the news topics that I have.
Well, good. That's all I've got, too. Let's talk about Texas Frightmare Weekend, which is February 22nd to the 24th, and Dead Pit will be there, represented by Jay Real and Ray Boucher.
Right. I think we're going to have a satellite feed that leads directly into the Dead Pit studios,
right. Where
we're going to be transmitting. We'll
have live updates from Jay Real.
Yeah.
We'll be keeping it real all weekend there at the Dead Pit table.
It'll be like that satellite feed that Pee-wee had in Pee-wee's Playhouse, where we're on the screen.
What? We have, though, is for... Here's the deal. Here's what we're going to do for the fans. We're going to have Dead Pit pins, limited edition pins, that will be given away that weekend. Now, for anyone that actually goes up to J-Reel and says you're from the message board, and you give them your name on the message board and stuff like that, you'll get the entire pin set.
Four pins.
Yeah.
There's two Dead Pit pins with the two Dead Pit designs that are most well known with the site, and there's one pin exclusive to me, Uncle Bill, and one pin exclusive to CK over here.
Yay. So you'll get the entire pin set if you're a regular listener to Dead Pit Radio. Just mention that, and you'll get a pin set. How about that? But also, they're going to have a big 40th anniversary reunion of Night of the Living Dead. They're going to have pretty much everyone that's still alive there at that show from Night of the Living Dead, and they're going to have a big screening and stuff like that. And just tons and tons of guests. Everybody go to TexasFrightmareWeekend.com and check all that out. And also coming up March 7th through 9th, the Dead Pit Connection in Texas is also going to have a Dead Pit table there at the Texas Fear Fest show, which is looking to be probably one of the biggest conventions ever in the United States.
Yeah, I've talked about this before. As far as guest lists go, I don't think I've ever seen any guest list that big.
Yeah.
But, I mean, really, like, Jay and Ray are living my dream by getting to go to these two fucking conventions. I hope they realize that.
JJ and Ray Ray.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, just guests like Robert Englund, Heather Langenkamp, Amanda Wise. A lot of people from the Nightmare on Elm Street film.
Like, yeah, I mean, a lot of people. Some people say that, but this, we're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 5 reunion.
Yeah.
That's how many people they've got this.
You were actually talking about Kim Meyer from Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which I don't think she's ever done a show.
Well, they've got almost everybody from all those films. From 1 to 5, there's almost every cast member.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, so you'll definitely have to go check out txfearfest.com for that. And the pins will also be there, hopefully, too, and we can you can get your pins the same deal for that. So now the screenings we want to talk about is there's actually two of them. George A. Romero's Diary of the Dead is being released limitedly, only like 26, 27 theaters, I think. And that sucks.
Yeah. You know? We're not anywhere near it, so we're not going to be able to
see it. And you know what sucks even more is you can't, like, I would love to get screener copies of some of this. And something that's being released that limitedly, why not? Why not give out screener copies to people that can't go, but whatever. And also, a movie that I know Uncle Bill's definitely looking forward to. We've seen previews for it for months. I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it. Step Up to the Streets comes out this week. And, you know, I'm just a big breakdance fan, stuff like that. And I just cannot wait to go see this movie. I want to pop it like it's hot and drop it like it's hot and every which other way you can drop it.
You feel me?
Yeah.
Yo.
It. Anybody else that can't, you know, dance it like that's fucking whack, yo.
Yeah, if you can't bust out those fresh new steps, you need to hit the bricks.
I'm going to be pop-locking and street-hopping and everything.
Has anybody
else
pop-locked since, like, 1985?
I'm going to, goddammit. I'm going to be doing the robot. I'll tell you, man, Boogaloo Shrimp has been teaching me the moves.
I want to do the funky cold Medina.
Yeah. So that's Step Up to the Streets.
I swear, man, every time I see that preview for that Step to the Streets, I think to myself, this is going to be like this generation's Breaking 2.
Right.
Like, they're going to look back on this and make fun of it forever.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of people making fun of it today, so I don't imagine like 10 years from now.
Oh, God. Okay. Oh. Ain't nothing to nah. Oh, shit. February 19th, DVD releases. There's actually quite a few this week. There wasn't that many last week, I remember. You've got Blackwater from Sony Pictures. You got Catacombs from Lionsgate, which I think somebody will be reviewing. It's not going to be me. We've got that one, though. You got Eyes Front from Image. Gabriel Special Edition from Sony Pictures. The German Expressionism Collection. Oh, God. Avoid this like the fucking plague. It's got The Hands of Orlok, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Secrets of a Soul, and Warning Shadows from Kino. You've got The Invasion HD DVD from Warner Brothers. You've got Naked Beneath the Water from Phoenix. Nightmare Detective from Dimension Extreme. Revamped from MTI. Spiral, the new Adam Green film from Anchor Bay, which I thought we would get by now, and apparently not. I'm glad we didn't, to be honest, but you know, that's how it goes. Zebra Man from Tokyo Shock and Media Blasters.
I'd like to see Spiral.
Would you?
Yeah.
I wouldn't. Why? Cause. Have you seen Hatchet?
Yep, that's Hatchet. This is Spiral.
Give a shit. Anybody make something that bad, they ain't going to make a good one the second time around, are they?
Buddy, you need to quit, buddy. It's
a bias towards Adam Green. He's a nice guy. I'm sorry. I don't really have anything against Adam Green. I just think that movie was horrible.
Okay. So, with that, I think we're done. We need to get to that special interview with Eric Stanzi of Wicked Pixel Cinema.
Yeah, let's talk to the Stanzi.
Yeah. So we'll be back after this interview, part one, actually, of two. The next part will be next week. Here on DeadPit.com.
At what point did you take interest in films, and what were some of your early favorites growing up?
Probably the early Evil Dead pushed me towards thinking that I could make them myself, but I was struck at an early age by Star Wars more than anything. Like when I was maybe 6 or 7 or something like that when I first saw Star Wars, and that was the first thing that really pushed me hard. And then Evil Dead was probably the first movie I saw that made me think, hey, I could probably do this myself too.
Now, was that something that you wanted to try to do with Savage Harvest, the original Savage Harvest?
I think probably my interest in Evil Dead definitely fueled Savage Harvest in terms of style. I think I don't know if I really knew what I was doing when I made Savage Harvest, just like I didn't really know what I was doing when I made my student films. So I'm sort of exploring what I could and could not accomplish at that young age. I was mainly ripping off, you know, other filmmakers just to see if I could do something like what they've done. So I was ripping off Sam Raimi, and I was ripping off Nightmare on Elm Street, and I was ripping off Hitchcock. And it wasn't until I made Eyes from the Sun that I actually started to try to speak with my own voice, I guess, as a filmmaker.
Were there any directors, other than, like, I'm sure you, Sam Raimi, which you mentioned, that, you know, influenced you to become a director?
As far as Raimi, it was specifically Evil Dead that of his catalog that pushed me, but probably more influential directors for me would be Romero and, I guess, maybe even Cronenberg and also Kubrick. Those guys have probably been a little more influential over the whole course of my career from student up until today. Also, Coppola has Apocalypse Now is one of my favorite movies of all time. So those guys are probably a little more influential to me than Raimi.
Cool. Now, did you go to any kind of film school or anything like that?
No, I have a formal training in television, but as far as filmmaking goes, I've never, other than basic film appreciation classes that you take in college. I don't have any education, formal education in filmmaking whatsoever.
I did want to ask you a couple of questions about Savage Harvest because it was probably the first film that we both saw of yours, and I know is that your earliest film?
Yeah, that is the first movie that I would I would consider my first professional movie and put quotes around the word professional. You've seen it, you know why. Just because that's the first movie I made after I graduated college and was able to, you know, I was no longer making student films. That was my first sort of attempt at doing this professionally as part of my career. So
where did the cast crew members come from?
For Savage Harvest specifically?
Yeah, or just in general, because I know you work with a lot of the same people over the years.
Well, some of the guys on Savage Harvest came from high school and college, and we hold auditions for Savage Harvest? Yeah, we held auditions for Savage Harvest, so some of the people that worked on that movie, we met during those auditions for the first time, and they joined on, and some of them stuck around for just Savage Harvest, and some of them still work with me on and off to this day, well over a decade later. So that's kind of how, it's like the casting for all of the movies is different. Sometimes we hold auditions, and sometimes we don't hold auditions. We just cast by recommendation, or I cast from people that I've worked with before, so each movie is a little bit unique in how we cast the parts and accumulate crew. Mm-hmm.
Did you notice, though, around that time period when you were filming Savage Horrors, because I know that the horror scene was pretty dead then compared to now, that was it a little more difficult to maintain a cast that would be willing to film, you know, at a specific time?
In terms of keeping, like, my cast and crew motivated to stay in the movie?
Yeah.
No, actually, it was a lot easier than it is today, believe it or not, because back then it contracts and getting screwed over by distributors. None of that had happened to me yet. You know, financial problems were not constantly hanging over me. So it was a very sort of pure time in my life. It was just about making the movie. And the same goes for the entire cast and crew. And today, you get a mix of a lot of different things because now I'm dealing with more professional people. So there's always the issue of, can we pay this person? Can we pay them enough to be a part of this project? And then, of course, you actually have, nowadays, you have an issue when you're dealing with more experienced and professional actors. A lot of them like to think that they're above the horror genre. So if you're making a horror movie, there might be an actor locally that I really want to work with, but they're kind of thinking, oh, great, I don't want to do a crappy horror movie because that's above that. They got that kind of garbage to deal with, too. So it was actually easier when we were making Savage Harvest.
How about back in the day, though? This was really before the internet hit big and stuff, the distribution aspect. Mm-hmm. When you released the film finally, what was that like?
Again, it was at that early stage, it was surprisingly easy. The reason why I even went into this thing thinking I could make a career of it was because two of my early student movies had caught the eye of a distributor and they were released to home video. And that same distributor was actually planning on releasing Savage Harvest before we even started shooting it. So essentially I had a distribution deal in place from the day that I submitted a script and said this is the next movie I'd like to make. Now that distributor ended up not releasing it. They went through a lot of changes right as we were shooting and as we were in post-production, and another distributor picked it up. That second distributor, they were pretty much, they showed up right there on the day that I lost the original distributor, so the search was not lengthy at all. It was actually surprisingly easy at first. And I think there were probably fewer distributors out there that were handling that kind of movie. Now it seems like there are a lot more distributors that will take the lower budgeted non-studio movies that don't necessarily have big names in them. I think it's potentially a little bit easier now for these kinds of movies to get distribution compared to back then, but Savage Harvest, somehow it just kind of clicked into place for me.
Now I was going to ask, if you mentioned getting, you know, having problems with distribution, and I'm sure you've had some other problems with, you know, producers and such like that, but is any of that the reason why you formed Wicked Pixel Cinema?
When we formed it, it was actually the distribution issues and financial issues hadn't really emerged, because this was back in 1995 when Wicked Pixel formed. So those problems hadn't really become big problems for me yet. The real reason that I wanted to form the company at the time was actually, it was kind of naive. I was just thinking that I didn't want the spotlight on me all the time, 100%. And I thought, well, if I formed this company, then this would be sort of a place that people would feel comfortable coming to and becoming a part of, and it would just, I felt like it would just sort of nurture the team aspect of the filmmaking. And then, of course, it helped to establish it as a company, and then this was that way, you know, I could have other people handle things like distribution negotiations or whatever, and these other people could say, yes, I work for Wicked Pixel Cinema. And that, it basically just kind of took the spotlight off of me and gave a larger group of people a home to work in.
Yeah.
Another film, though, we wanted to touch on was Scrapbook, which we both recently saw, and it was a really twisted movie, to say the least. How did you cast Emily Hack in the role? Because I think that was probably the most difficult role anyone could play in a film.
Yeah, we got lucky with Emily. I didn't know Emily very well. I met her during post-production on Ice from the Sun, and she just sort of came in to see what I was doing, and she looked at some of the early the editing that was going on with Ice from the Sun. She expressed an interest in being involved, and she was going to Webster University, which is the St. Louis's, I guess, their top film school. directing, she was interested in writing, and she was interested in acting. The scrapbook was developed with Tom Biondo. He and I worked together on that, developing that movie, and I think there were some other actresses that Tom had his eye on early on in the game, but I never had any real interaction with those actresses, and then he brought Emily to me one day, and the three of us just kind of sat down and talked about what this movie was going to be, and so Emily was on board, and very, you know, the way she talked, she seemed very brave about it, and I thought, okay, let's give this a shot. So Emily was actually the first and last person to be considered for that role.
Now, I was going to ask, was there any difficulties on the shoot, because this is pretty sensitive subject matter, to say the least.
There were difficulties in that things got so intense and so grim. There was, it became a difficult atmosphere to work in from time to time. By the time we were shooting Scrapbook, we were all, you know, pretty close friends. You know, by that time, Emily was a good friend of ours because she worked with us off and on various small projects after Ice from the Sun, and she'd come to work with her through pre-production on Scrapbook. So she was a friend of ours, and it actually was upsetting to see her go through some of those attack scenes that were obviously pretty brutal. And, you know, we were trying to make it as real as possible, so it actually hurt a little for just me and for cast and crew to see Emily go through the things that she was going through. And so it just, there was an uncomfortable atmosphere a lot, by, in terms of people problems, or, you know, it's not like at any point, you know, Emily got upset and said, I'm not going to do this anymore unless we change this or this. And it's not like at any point Tom got upset and said, no way, I'm not going to do this. I mean, there were no people problems whatsoever on that movie. It was actually extremely smooth sailing. We didn't even have any real logistical problems. There were no locations getting pulled from under us. There were no money problems. I mean, that was an extremely smooth shoot, actually. So.
Yeah, another thing that I noticed about the film is at the beginning it says it was based on actual events. And I know some people just use that sometimes to drum up publicity, but was that actually based on a real story?
Well, Tom Biondo spent a lot of time doing research before we ever even before we went into actual pre-production, and it is based on actual events, but from what I understand, from the way Tom was putting it together, what I understand, it's actually an accumulation of multiple stories. So that specific, you know, beginning to end story did not actually happen, but it is everything in the movie is based on several disparate events.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the initial reaction to the finished film when people, you know, first saw it?
Well, cast and crew, I remember screening it for cast and crew, and that pretty much resulted in just stunned silence. And we had various reactions from some of them. Some of them were like, wow, we did something really interesting and unique here. And then some of them were very honest in telling me, wow, I wish I had asked for my name to not be in those credits. And we had a lot of that kind of stuff. I remember when we were shooting the movie, though, I looked at everybody on the set, like after, I think, a day or two of shooting, and we had already shot some really brutal, nasty stuff, and I looked at everybody on the set, and I said, you know, guys, this is not going to get into Blockbuster. This is never going to get into the big retail chain. This is a movie that likely 10 people are going to see, and then it's just going to fade off into oblivion. Is everyone comfortable continuing forward making this movie, knowing that it just might be too rough for anybody to watch and that it's not going to have any staying power? And everybody said, yeah, let's continue moving forward. To this date, it's still, out of everything I've directed, it's the most notorious and one of the better reviewed movies, and it's certainly stuck around a lot longer than we thought, and a lot more people have seen it than we thought would see it. So we have mostly positive reactions to it from people in the genre, or people who like the genre, or people who are in the industry. Mm-hmm. But we have had a lot of backlash to it as well. We've had, you know, a lot St. Louis where we live, or not exactly an open-minded community, so I've had some attacks against me, and Emily's had some attacks against her. People that didn't even, a lot of people who haven't even seen the movie, or they maybe put it in and they watched the first 20 minutes and they're offended, and just people really, you know, speaking out against me, speaking out against Emily and Wicked Pixel, and you get a little bit of that, but for the most part, the reaction has been very positive.
Another thing about the film, though, is, and I couldn't help but be reminded of films like August Underground when I saw it, but you were pretty much ahead of the curve of making a film like that in that style. What made you decide to make a film that was so, it basically had like two characters in the film, shot in one place, you know, et cetera?
Well, the idea of the story was brought to me by Tom. That was pretty much the way he envisioned it initially. And I think what I latched onto was the fact that I had just come off of making Ice from the Sun, which was a very lengthy shoot, and it was very complex. We were in a different location for virtually every scene, and I think for a movie at Ice from the Sun's budget level, I think we still hold a record of sorts of being a movie shot in the greatest number of locations for a single independent movie. And I think we beat most Hollywood movies even for a number of locations in Ice from the Sun. And it was just a lot of travel, and it was a lot of work, and it was a lot of just sort of having to sit there and kind of be tough and put up with a lot of these elements to get that movie made. And the biggest thing that attracted me to making this smaller movie, Scrapbook, was just the fact that it was a smaller movie. I was down for, okay, we're going to shoot it in 13 days. We're going to shoot it at basically two locations. And that attracted me to it. But then I thought, if we're going to do something that is about the serial rapist killer guy, if we're going to do that, it can't be just another knockoff, you know, just another bland, using the same techniques, going to the same places that a thousand other movies have gone to. If we're going to do it about the subject matter, it has to be real, and it has to have impact, and we have to go farther than we've seen it go before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's important to keep using the same, you know, local actors, or would you, you know, be up for casting someone else involved in the genre? Is there anyone else you'd like to work with, actor-wise?
I'm intrigued by the mix of the two. I like working with people. I like having sort of those anchors in the cast, people that I've worked with before and rely on, and I don't have, that's just, you know, one less thing that you got to worry about when you're preparing for a shoot or when things start going a little haywire. It's like, if you've got people that you count on, that lessens the stress. But I'm also always interested in finding new people, especially, well, I guess cast and crew. I like working with new people all the time. And I think something that's held us back in the past is that we haven't had any name actors in any of our movies. We've tried to build names for people. We've tried to build names for, you know, Emily Hack or Jason Christ or whatever, but we haven't actually gone out and sought someone with name value to begin with and asked them to be a part of the movie. And that's something that we're transitioning into now, partly because I think it would be fun, but also just economically, you have to include somebody like that in your cast if you're going to make the sales that you need to make to justify spending the money on the movie. So there are a few people that I've got my eye on, and these are people that some of them have no idea who the hell I am, and then some of them have expressed a sincere interest in being in an Eric Stanzi movie, so...
I really wanted to touch briefly on Savage Harvest 2 because I guess the main thing I noticed about that film is that you didn't really have anything to do with the directing and anything else. I wondered why that was.
Well, I've learned to appreciate what the first Savage Harvest is. I know the first Savage Harvest has its fan base, and I understand why those fans like that movie. I do not see Savage Harvest as a well-made movie at all. It's not something that I'm, you know, really proud of these days. I tend to progress and learn from from my mistakes and try to make a better movie, so the further back you go in my catalog, the more embarrassed I am at the work that I've done. And so Savage Harvest is pretty far back there, and I kind of look at it like, wow, I didn't do a very good job directing that movie. So I had no interest in making a sequel to it at all. And Jason Chris happened to be a big fan of the original Savage Harvest, and Jason actually brought it up to me. He came to me and said, hey, I'm thinking about writing a Savage Harvest 2. Would you be into that? And I said, yeah, that would be, I finally just told him, yeah, that's acceptable, but there's no way I would want to direct that. And I think Jason may have already had his heart set on directing it anyway, so it was something that I did not want to do at all and something Jason really wanted to do, but it fell into place quite nicely.
Well, now, having seen it, what did you think about the film?
The sequel?
Yeah.
It's, I found it to be infinitely better than the first movie, first of all, and it has its rough spots. But I think that it was important to let Jason kind of do something that was personal to him and do it in a style that was more what Jason wanted, as opposed to me trying to flex any muscle and push it into an area that either I wanted it to go into or into an area that I thought might be more profitable. Mm-hmm. So the lessons that I've learned over the years is that if you do let the director do what they want to do. Like Scrapbook is something where if I had a producer or an investor with a lot of money breathing down my neck on Scrapbook saying, well, we got to make this movie safe, we got to make this movie marketable, then it would have been bland and it would have gone nowhere. Mm-hmm. In fact, we've had the opposite results. It's been one of the more successful things we've done because I just did what I wanted to do with it. So I always have faith. I trust a director at the onset. I'm going to have faith that they know what they're doing, and I'm going to. My role was to support Jason's artistic goals on Harvest 2, not to try to steer him into one direction or another. And when I saw the finished movie, I thought he pulled it off nicely, and I actually thought the script was. I thought he really stood out as a screenwriter, like amazingly compared to other movies. We made it this budget level for this genre. I thought from a script writing standpoint, it was extremely well executed. Overall, I was very happy with it.
Welcome back to Dead Pit Radio. We'd like to thank our good friend Eric Stanzi for doing the interview with us. And remember, part two of the interview is next week on Dead Pit.
Yeah, I actually want to thank Eric Stanzi and Scott Muck, both from Wicked Pixel.
The Muckster, Muckamania's Run Wild Brother.
Mm-hmm. Old Mucky Brewster, yeah. For hooking us up with the interview. And for just generally being a good guy that actually does take time out to listen to the show as well.
Indeed. So we want to get some fan questions. Again, we usually do have a call-in portion around this time. Thursdays, usually at 8 p.m., we take phone calls. 1-606-658-0185 is where you can reach us. Or if you have the Skype program, you can just contact us directly with the username Dead Pit. We're pretty easy to get a hold of, aren't we, Uncle Bill?
That's true. You can call us anytime. We're always open for conversation.
So, I have some questions here, of course. The first question is from Cthulhu for you. Cthulhu for you. How many shows actually give their own board members their own separate song? The intros.
I can't think of any, really.
That's another first here at Dead Pit. I mean, we're the innovators of Horror Talk Radio, and we're the innovators of message board theme songs.
We're also the innovators of giving everybody a nickname. Yeah. I know that, too. Like we don't care what your name is. We can come up with a nickname for it.
So, our buddy Cthulhu says, I can't believe you guys forgot Two Evil Eyes on your February 8th show. This Argento/Romero film was pretty cool, as I remember. The reason we didn't mention Two Evil Eyes, I mean, maybe we forgot to mention it.
Because
I don't really like the movie. I actually own the movie. I have the movie, but I don't really remember liking it that much.
I've seen it one time, and there's one time that we watched it, and I remember I didn't like it at all, really.
So,
probably one that just escapes my attention.
It's got a couple of good death scenes in it and stuff, but overall, I really didn't like the movie that much, honestly. He also asks, there is Night Train to Terror with the gayest 80s band ever on a train with God and Satan who relate the stories of three souls the two are fighting over. He says, we've got Richard Mull and a claymation Antichrist.
Mm.
The movie sucks, but it's bloody and it's fun if you like that crap. I actually own the VHS of it, but I've yet to watch it. It's one of those deals where I bought it on eBay pretty cheap. So we will probably check that out sometime
soon. I don't know how you couldn't watch something with a synopsis like that.
Yeah, I remember hearing about the movie and that it was so bad it's good. So another one he wanted to mention is Alien Zone, a.k.a. House of the Dead. Total piece of shit. This thing stinks worse than Bigfoot's fleshlight.
Yeah.
I don't even know if Bigfoot would use a fleshlight. He'd probably just get like a handful of mud and fuck it or something.
A mossy tree trunk shoving up his ass.
He says, also check out After Midnight, Dead Time Stories, Tales from the Hood, and The Devil's Messenger.
Yeah, now Dead Time Stories and Tales from the Hood, I do remember both of those, and especially Tales from the Hood. I think Ernest Dickerson directed that, didn't he?
I don't know.
Or was that?
No, he directed Bones.
Somebody directed that, John Sayles, somebody like that that I know. But yeah, that was the one that had, was that guy's name, Clarence T. Williams?
Mm.
It was like the funeral,
Mortician.
Yeah, the guy that runs the funeral parlor. And all the, the two thugs come in there, and he's telling them all these different stories, and then at the end it has, like, a wraparound story that involves them. I do remember liking that one pretty well, actually.
He also says the point of the Twilight Zone segment about the old people was that they become young again after playing Kick the Can. It was the whole, you are only as old as you think you are deal, which I don't know if we even talked about that segment that much. We just pretty much went through them. We didn't go through the...
Yeah, I still don't know what the point of it is. Like, if the point of it is play Kick the Can to make yourself young, I still don't. Like, what's the overall message to that?
Yeah.
You're only whatever.
Yeah, that was a pretty bad episode. It was surprising, too, since Spielberg directed that one.
That's just false information to give old people. If they go outside and play Kick the Can, that's all something going to make them 80 years younger.
No, it'll probably kill them, actually.
It'll probably break a hip.
Yeah. So that's from Cthulhu for You, and we appreciate all the fan questions we get every week, and we probably have more time to actually talk about the stuff this week since we aren't taking phone calls. So.
Here's a question from Mikey Likes It, Mikey Cantrell.
Yeah, buddy.
Have you guys ever considered having a show notes section on the site? Reason being, I listen to the show driving a lot of times, and I can't write down all the movies I want to watch that you guys talk about. Just an idea.
Well, a weird thing about that is we do have that. That's in the synopsis of the show. We usually list the movies out.
That's for the movies that we review and stuff. I guess he's talking about movies that we talk about. Like when we did the horror anthology show, I know a lot of people were confused because we went through so many of them that I guess we only mentioned them one time. But I guess in the future, if we do something like that, we could have like a list of all the movies that we talk about. That wouldn't be too hard to put together.
Yeah. Or maybe we could just get somebody that listens to the show to do it.
Transcribe a list.
Yeah,
it's not a bad idea, but I always try, when we're doing reviews especially, to mention the movie at the beginning and then at the end of the review so people will know what it is we're talking about.
Yeah.
So hopefully that'll work.
We got something here from Axlish, who wants to know what our plans are for Valentine's Day, and do you guys have better halves or what?
I plan on sitting around the house and sticking a rump roast up my butt.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's what I usually like to do during Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Well, what I'm planning on doing is, since we actually skipped the Peking dinner this week,
mm-hmm.
and there's the one little bony girl that always likes to see us coming and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think I want to offer to eat her ass all out with some chicken chow mein. Make her feel better.
Oh! You want pussy with her ass?
Oh! I thought that'd be a fun, that'd be a good Valentine's Day gift.
Yeah.
Like, I think all women would enjoy that.
All women love a tongue up their butt.
Especially with chicken chow mein.
Chicken chow mein tongue up their butt. I mean, come on, seriously.
Yeah. So, that's our plans. What are y'all's plans for the Valentine's season? So.
I sincerely can't believe you went there, but that's still. Well.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I was being honest. I mean.
Well, I don't know. Nice looking holes down there. Nice looking Asian women. All right. This is a pretty long question from Darren the Redneck. Because I'm going to try to keep this short. Well, you tried, didn't you?
Yeah. Well, you're lucky you hit us in a week where we're not doing a whole lot. We're just taking the fan question. So.
I want you guys to know that I love the show and that this is just a hypothetical. That said, do you think that if you guys were the same age about 20 years ago and running the Dead Pit Show, would you be bitching about how nothing is coming out but crappy slasher films and sequels? Actually, to reword that, do you think if you would have grown up on the Hammer era, would you have felt that people of our generation who couldn't wait to see what new ways Jason or Freddy could kill someone were much different than the modern kids waiting for the next jigsaw trap or hostile torture device? Or even if there was a 70s Dead Pit Show, would you be pissed about why these Hammer fools feel they need to remake the tales that Universal did to perfection? I think everything has its place, and although I'm not a great fan of what's coming out right now, I'm sure that in 20 years or so, people will be raising hell over the Saw and Hostel remakes, which were their favorite films. A lot of these PG-13 movies are focused on the youth of today instead of us diehard fans. I usually think that they suck ass. But in the 80s, I'm sure the 25 to 35-year-olds were saying the same thing about Monster Squad, Lost Boys, etc. They're in the redneck.
You can't be sure about that because in that day and time, they were actually making original movies. See, this day and time is, you can't really compare it to any other in my eyes because there's nothing, well, in the majority, there's nothing new being released. You know, everything is, oh, let's go back to, you know, The Hills Have Eyes. Let's go back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Hell, even let's go back to Chud. They want to just revisit everything in the past. And that's why I think that we're so upset about this current time period. I mean, I love to go check out a movie that's actually something different, something new. Like when we watched 30 Days a Night, you know, that was something completely new. And it was just totally refreshing. Same thing with Cloverfield. I'm really just sick and tired of just this, you know, rehashing of the same movies over and over and over again.
I think that what I would say to this is, he makes some good points because Hammer did basically rip off the Universal stuff, and I'm sure that pissed a lot of people off at the time. And basically, I think what he's trying to get at is that people back in that era probably thought a lot of the same things that we do now because of the nostalgia factor, which I don't really think you can just completely disregard the nostalgia thing. There are some films that I like that I know for a fact that the main reason I like them is because I liked them when I was a kid. And that that's just part of like what that movie was. But that being said, for me, there are certain universal things that make a film bad that you can always bitch about no matter if it's now or 40 years ago. Bad directing's one of them. Bad acting's one of them. Horrible fucking character development's another one of them. Like, there's all kinds of stuff that it doesn't have to be. There's certain universal concepts in making a movie. I don't give a damn what kind of movie it is that people tend to forget,
yeah,
or they just don't know how to do it. And when that comes along, especially comes along with remakes, because a lot of these people came from like music videos and shit like that. That's usually what complain about. And originality, of course, is one of the bigger problems.
I think that's the big problem. I mean, acting was never a huge thing in horror anyway. I mean, you could be the shittiest actor in the world and, you know, still be regarded. You know, look at Linnea Quigley. I mean, I love Linnea Quigley and everything, but she never really could act. You know, to me, that's not a big thing in horror. But originality, I think, is a huge problem in today's films. I mean, obviously. So I just don't think, other than maybe that you mentioned the Hammer stuff, but even then, I mean, that's not. Nowadays, they're taking movies verbatim and remaking them, you know. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, but I do agree with what he's saying, though, which is, and you would have to agree with this, too, that there's some movies that you like more just because of the time that they were made in.
Yeah, but that's for everybody. It's not just us. That's people like, you know, that grew up in the 50s and 60s that watched monster movies. Some people actually think that Frankenstein Meets the Space Monster is a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't say it's just for us, but it is. I mean, should that really be a criteria for liking movies is because you grew up with them?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, then.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think it should. I can't think of too many movies, though, that I loved as a kid and still don't get some type of enjoyment out of, though. And I mean, even if I hadn't seen them, I still think I would have liked them.
I just have a real hard time believing, though, honestly, that people today will look, and this probably is kind of naive because I'm sure this probably will happen, that people today will look back on films like Hostel 2 and be like, God, I wish they could make shit like that again.
Yeah, or even the Saw movies, because there's, besides the gore and just the brutalness of the movies, there's nothing else really to them. And even people would argue out that about Friday the 13th. But Friday the 13th actually had some camp in it as well. You know, it had just your cheesy characters and just the overall, it wasn't a mean-spirited type of film like Hostel or, you know, the Saw films.
I noticed that this argument, though, it does, it gets a lot of traction. It's the argument of you can't really judge films today unless you're, like, kind of in the genre, or not the genre, but in the category of people that they make the films for. Like, unless you're 18 to 24 years old, you can't really judge these films because that's who they make the films for, and that's people that will remember the films when they get older and all this stuff and yada, yada, yada. But like I said, there are certain universal things about films in general, and especially horror films, that make them good or bad. I don't give a shit, like, what decade it's in. It's just always been that way.
Yeah.
And a lot of these directors can't even get that right.
Yeah, I think regardless of what decade, if we did the show in the 70s or 80s or 90s, I think that we would still overall be fair. And I think we are fair to the majority of films that come out, honestly.
Yeah.
Look at Hostel, or I mean, Saw 4. I mean, everybody knows we hate the fuck out of those movies. But we were honest and we went to see the movie and actually said that it was a little better than Saw 3. You know, we're not going to completely, you know, bitch about something one way or another. We're going to be honest about certain aspects of the movie.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong about this, because I don't really want to go see those movies.
Yeah.
Like, if we weren't doing this, if I wasn't trying to be fair about it, I would never go see those movies. I would have never gone see Saw 4 or Hostel 2. But I was doing it because, you know, I know that people want to hear a review of it, and they want to see what we like.
I know
don't like about
a lot of people may not think that we're fair, but I honestly believe that we're fair to the majority of films that come out. Honestly,
I mean, I really believe that too.
So, next question from Kelly the Beast Marcotte, who says, "Hey guys, greetings from the Arctic wasteland known as Milwaukee." And yes, folks, it definitely is the Arctic wasteland because he sent us some photos of the snowstorm they had recently there. I think it was 50-plus inches of snow. And I believe for the past 10 years, we probably haven't seen that much snow combined.
Probably not.
He says, seeing that your special theme show seemed to go over so well, have you ever thought about putting together a Salute to Serial Killers show? Just talk about all the movies.
Like Salute Your Shorts.
Yeah.
Salute Serial Killers.
Just talk about all the movies about true-life serial killers. I don't mean movies like Texas Chainsaw or Psycho, which are loosely based. I mean films that are trying to tell the story of an actual serial killer. He says maybe throw in Henry, too. Yeah, you could do a whole section on Louis Malle films. No, I don't want to do that. You know one movie, though, when we were doing our year in review show, and I think, what was the worst movie you saw of the year? Was it
Halloween?
No, it wasn't Halloween. It was what was that fucking movie? Tiffany Shepard, that shitty ass.
Oh, yeah, that was my worst independent film. That was Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, I go back though and say, and thinking about it more because I didn't prepare for that stuff. Ula Mel's Mummy Maniac is probably one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my whole life, and I saw that last year, but I forgot about it. Luckily. That just reminded me, though, of Ula Mel.
Here's the thing, though, about what he says real quick before you get onto the last part of it. He says, you maybe throw in there Henry, too, but Henry is actually based on Henry Lee Lucas, which was a real-life serial killer. And it's pretty, from what I understand, pretty much stays to the real true story of him, so yeah. It wouldn't be too far off to do a movie like that in that list.
Well, and he says maybe as a guest you could have John Borowski on talking about his researching his documentaries and also upcoming serial killer Doc Panzram, which I guess is Carl Panzram,
yep.
The serial killer. Just a thought, keep up the horror goodness. And I think that'd be a good idea for a specialty show. We seem to...
Well, you know I love that idea. I mean, I'm a big fan of serial killers.
You're a big old fan of serial killers. Yeah, we enjoy doing the specialty shows from time to time. And in a couple of weeks, we're going to try to do another horror roundtable. And I guess we should... That's a specialty show. That's probably our most popular specialty show. And putting out an invitation to all those that'd be interested in doing it. You can just email us, deadpit@deadpit.com. Right now, we don't have anybody as the guest for the roundtable other than myself and Uncle Bill. So if you're interested in that, we're going to be doing that probably 2 weeks from tonight, and everyone can look forward to that. I think it's our first roundtable in about 6 months, so it should be a pretty big deal. So thanks
to... Yeah, you should definitely send your... horology certificates in, and all degrees. We need all that stuff for records.
And I'll just say this. If you're not going to talk, do not submit. The whole thing is giving your opinion.
Yeah, it's a round table. It's kind of important that you
So if you're
talk.
Going to freeze up, like, let's see. I don't know, guys. What do you think, guys? Don't submit, please.
Just don't do it. So real quick, though, I can think... of a couple of serial killer movies off the top of my head that I actually like, and a couple that I really don't, but the Ted Bundy one, I think it was just called Bundy, or was it Ted Bundy?
I don't even know.
It might have been Ted Bundy, but the one that has Tiffany Shepis in it, I really like that one. That's probably one of my overall favorites of the new wave of those kind of movies.
One that I really liked a lot was, and I've talked about this before, is the Steve Railsback version of Ed Gein. I thought that was one of the better. I think all the same people do those movies, actually. But that was one of the better Ed Gein movies.
There was one that came out recently from Lionsgate that was a Richard Speck one.
Dick Speck.
Like the Chicago Murders or something to that effect. It wasn't that great. It had Corin Nemec in it from Parker Lewis Can't Lose.
Yeah.
And I believe Debbie Rochon was in that one, too.
Yeah, and another one that was really good is The Manson Family, which our good friend Jim Van Bebble, Jim Van Bebble, directed. And I enjoyed that one a lot, too. That was actually a movie that took him about 20 years to finish.
Now, of course, there's an untold amount of Zodiac films, with the most recent being the David Fincher one. We kind of disagreed on it, but I actually, people fucking hate this. I like the Zodiac film that had Robin Tunney in it that came out directly before that one.
I mean, there's a lot of pretty good serial killer movies that we could talk about. So, eventually we'll probably do that.
I've got like more of a comment here than it is a question from Ulf, who says, just wanted to say thank you for reading my question.
Thanks.
In the latest show, I'm working on fixing a list of all the Swedish gore horror movies I can find. Make sure to check out the list on the board. Thank you, Ulf. I know that a lot of people are really concerned about Swedish gore movies. I don't even know. I had no idea that there was a whole subgenre of that shit that existed. But he's got a list on there that's probably about 30 films long.
Swedish gore, buddy. You got to love it. We've got a question here that is from Stephen West, all the way in the UK. He says, hey there, guys. I'm an English horror fan. No, don't hold that against me. I can't help from being English. I guess I live in an area roughly equivalent to the place in the U.S. where you live.
I doubt that.
Sorry for you. That's the case. He says, on the plus side, it at least means the priest was very understanding last weekend when I married my cousin's pet cat. Oh, okay. I wanted to express how much I enjoy the weekly dose of Dead Pit. I've been listening to the show for about 2 months, having discovered it via Rumorg's Guide to Horror Podcasts a couple of issues back, and that's actually issue 72 of Rumorg Magazine, featuring deadpit.com. All those that missed that.
It's the anniversary edition, the 10th anniversary edition.
He says, I only wish there was a similar broadcast in the UK that's as much fun as Dead Pit. he asked, do you guys have many UK listeners? And I believe we actually do. We actually have.
Yeah, I just found out recently that old Stuart Andrews, whose feedback is actually from Liverpool, England. He's not from fucking Scotland like we originally thought.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a lot of UK listeners and a lot of listeners from Australia, too. I mean, I don't know what the deal is with Australia. We have a ton of fuckers from Australia.
Yeah, I think there's a contingent of people down there that it's like a little cult following of the show. I think they all know each other, too. UK, who else do we have that's a UK fan? There's quite a few Scottish.
There's a lot of people on the board from the UK, and I don't really even, I couldn't even tell you.
There's
a lot of people.
I can tell you some of them right now. There's the Psycho Second Coming guy. I'm pretty sure he's from Australia, but I don't think he's Australian. Well, he might be. Then there's the
Dr. Blood's actually.
Dr. Blood's from the UK.
You could.
Who else? You got, what's the guy that called in that time that's Scottish? He's awesome.
He's Scottish. He's not from the UK.
Yeah, either. But I haven't heard from him in a long time.
Mr. Blonde.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a lot of foreign listeners. We actually have Gigantor is actually from China. He's one of the only people from China that listens to the show.
There's another guy, too. He goes by like a handle, Knock Monster or something like that. And I know he's from the UK because he's got one of the only UK horror podcasts that I know of.
Yeah. So you might have to check that out, Stephen. He also says, being a newcomer to your world, I'd be interested to learn how long Dead Pit has been running as a radio show. And maybe for the benefit of newcomers like me, could you describe on the show how you guys got into horror in the first place? I really enjoyed your horror anthology special last week, and I'm looking forward to more special type shows in the future. Maybe something on Scream Queens or 80s slasher flicks. By the way, I regularly write for websites, thehorrorreview.com and eatmybrains.com. If you want to check out some of my stuff, I'm also currently working on the third volume of a publication called Slash Hits that covers the history of the slasher movie.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like something I'd really enjoy. All the films are rated using a rating scale of blood bags and boobs, so there are a lot of tits on display.
Mm.
He says, I'll also be checking out a couple of commentaries you have on sale on the site soon. If they're as much fun as your show, I'm sure they'll be worth a couple pounds. Yeah, they're a whole hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah, they're more fun than the show.
Yeah.
They're so awesome, I can't hardly sit still.
Hopefully sometime soon we'll be doing another commentary and adding that on there. I know it'll be one of two movies. I think we've already talked about this. Either Phantasm or Dawn of the Dead.
Mm.
And if it's not one or the other, then that one will be next after it. So people can definitely check those ones out.
Probably the two films we know the most about.
Yeah.
As far as everything that goes on.
And we're going to mention this on here, but this might be the last time we mention this on here, because I'm thinking we're going to have to start like a frequently asked questions part on that board.
Well, there's a lot of people that come into this. We've been doing this show for, 3 years now?
Almost 3 years.
And a lot of people that come in a little bit late that may not realize, all the other people that have asked about how we started and stuff. So
I'm thinking, what I mentioned before, we can record audio files, put them up there, answering the questions so people can hear us in great detail.
And it's not a big deal to ask us the same question. It's just...
People get sick of hearing
it's
listening
really
to the show. So... Wants to know, could you describe what got you guys into horror? Is one question. Well, what got me into horror, I believe, was when I first got a VCR. My mom, believe it or not, at that point in time, actually did like horror films. She doesn't really like them anymore. And we rented a Friday the 13th film and a Psycho film and watched those. I pretty much got hooked on that. And I remember early on watching some of the TV shows on, like The Hitchhiker and, what else? Tales from the Dark Side.
Tales from the Crypt.
Stuff like that. And, that got me into it even more. And then sooner or later, it was like every weekend after I got home from school, we would go to the video store and rent. Sometimes it wasn't horror, but most of the times it was. I would rent, made sure I got to see all the Friday the 13th films and all the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, and then it got on to the more hardcore stuff a little bit later on. So that's pretty much video is what got me into horror. I don't think I ever watched anything in the theater until I was at least, you know, 7 or 8 years old.
There's a whole series of things that got me as far into horror as I am right now. And I'm sure that...
Well, just talk about it at an early age.
I'm sure that my story about how I got into horror is probably the same as a lot of people's story, because it's pretty universal the way people do it. When I was a kid, my father was kind of like one of those people that was very predisposed just to liking stuff that other people wouldn't like. He was kind of like a version of a hippie, and he just kind of liked stuff that's kind of outside the realm of the stuff that normal people would watch. So watched a lot of horror films and a lot of action and exploitation style films around that time. And like, he would make tapes back in the day. That was a big thing to do, is you'd rent tapes, and then you'd make like compilations on VHS tapes back before it was, you know, they put the macro shit on there where you couldn't copy them. So it was like, he would have tapes with Basket Case and, you know, they had one with Dawn of the Dead and Zombie and like a couple other zombie related films on it. And just all these things, like when I was growing up, that's the kind of stuff that I watched.
Yeah.
And eventually, like, it would get into stuff like Dead Alive in the 90s, stuff like that. And then from there, like, I was pretty much out of horror completely through most of the 90s. And then, like, everybody else, when Scream came along, that kind of got me restarted on it. And then the big thing of that time period was Anchor Bay coming out with DVDs. And then that's when DVDs really hit. And then I got into all that stuff because they were putting out all the Italian stuff. And
well, I think a lot of people, especially in rural areas where even the VHS tapes of some of that stuff was impossible to get, like the rental stores. I think the rental stores around here maybe only got Zombie. That was like the only Fulci movie they got.
Yeah.
And like some of this stuff, because I remember reading about it for years, like Gates of Hell was one of the first, I think it was actually the first DVD I ever bought, because I remember reading about that movie and some of the gore in that movie. And I think that movie actually, you know, around that same time period in the late 90s, early 2000s, gets you back into it full steam ahead, into the independent, hardcore, you know, foreign stuff like that. So
I think that the thing that cemented it completely, though, and you might agree with this, I don't know, was the first time we went to a convention. Like, I think after that,
well,
that was like the beginning of really being like hardcore fucking into collecting and just being obsessive about everything that had to do with horror movies.
Yeah, I believe, at that point we realized that we're not alone.
True, yeah.
And then there's fans that, you know, we might have thought we were super fans before, but once we saw some of the people there, we realized, no, I mean, there's a whole community of these people. And that was definitely a religious experience when it comes to being a horror fan, I guess. And I also wants to know how long has Dead Pit Running been running a radio show?
November 2005.
Well, I think early on. We'll talk about this. Early on, I think it was around early 2004, we started a separate site which was devoted to horror autographs, okay? And this is where we would seriously be like almost private investigators, finding some of these people's home addresses, home phone numbers, and contacting them, writing them, and telling them how much we appreciated their work, and we would love to get an autograph. And we would go so far to print out our own photos and get them signed. And through this, you know, I guess we could talk about some of the autographs we got. We got some pretty amazing stuff. Like, I don't know, like, I pretty much got the entire cast of the Monster Squad throughout, you know, the years.
We got everybody. We got Wes Craven, Dario Argento, John Carpenter,
Ridley Scott, which is a pretty big one. You know, just tons of people. I mean, we actually got in contact with, you know, who's who of horror, pretty much. Anybody you could think of. Jessica Harper from Suspiria.
Yeah, talking about this before with you, I don't know if we talked about it on the show or not, but I really wish that we would have known the shit that we know now back then, because we actually found a lot of these people that are doing these conventions now before they even had any idea about conventions, I'm sure, because before they even got back on the convention circuit, I mean, we're getting autographs from. I've got an autograph from Jason Lively. I know for a fact the very first convention he's doing is the one coming up here.
And how about Rogel Diodato?
Yeah.
One of the guys I actually contacted via email. And, yes, I do have his email. No, I'm not giving it to you. Actually, the guy can't speak English that well anyway, so it won't do you much good. But, yeah, I mean, we got in contact with all these, you know, and we actually become pretty well-known as Horrorgraph. The website is still up, but I don't have time to update it. I don't update it anymore. Horrorgraphs.com. And that actually got us pretty well-known as far as getting in contact with people. And through that, we got contacted to be a part of this horror magazine is what it was going to be at first. And that turned out to never really come to happen or anything.
Randy Gaston.
Yeah, the horror newsletter.
Yeah.
And I think that, whether or not you want to admit it or not, pretty much got us wanting to do something in the horror genre on a website. And eventually...
I don't want to admit that.
You might not want to admit it, but it's true. But the whole radio show idea, we actually pitched to him if he wanted to do it and have somebody else do it, because... our voices, I just didn't think people would, you know, where we're from the South, we're from Eastern Kentucky, that people would listen, that people would put up with the Southern twang that is Dead Pit now. So he didn't want to do it. He just, I don't know, he thought it was a bad idea and that it wouldn't work. But we got up enough balls to actually do it. I think the idea was in, like, what, probably August, September of 05, and we actually started, I think the first show was in December of 05, so, you know, that's how we started it, and I don't know, you know, people want to say that they were around before the Dead Pit radio show. I don't, you may have been, but I look for every, like, as far as I know, we were the very first people to do the show that we're doing. At that point in time, I mean, I searched for weeks and months trying to find another show that was like what we wanted to do, and I never could find it.
There was nothing like this. I don't care what anybody says. You may have had a show that you called a horror show, but I can guarantee you that it did not have the same format as us, because I don't think that format existed until we started doing it.
And
but
you know, and there's tons of those shows like that, and that's fine, I guess. But
going back a little bit, though, to when you were talking about the whole horror newsletter and all that shit, I can't help but think that the main reason that I wanted to do the stuff that we were doing as it relates to the horror newsletter was just because I hated the way things were run with that shit.
Yeah.
Because it was so edited, and he always didn't want you to talk about anybody, and you couldn't. Like, I remember saying something about Wes Craven, and he made me, like, edit out of some kind of review that I wrote. And then there was another thing where, like, I was on a goddamn... one of those list servers and said douche cock, and he fucking flipped out about that because I was somehow related to the horror newsletter. It's just like somebody taking that much time to censor what you're saying.
Well, yeah, and again, another thing that we could mention is the reason why we wanted to start the show is at the time there were not a lot of people speaking their minds about what was going on, other than maybe on message boards and stuff like that.
It wasn't just Fangoria.
I mean,
I know a lot of people think that, but that had a big part to do with it. But it was just everybody at that time was so fucking uptight about offending anybody or talking about things that needed to be talked about that it drove me insane, I know.
Yeah, and I think that while we do make fun of certain people and stuff, when we do it, it's all in good fun usually. I mean, we're not really hateful when we say this stuff. It's just all, you know, even the Eli Roth stuff, it's pretty much just how funny. Like, how fun can it be to just bash Eli Roth? That's the attitude we go into it with. So I guess that was a really detailed answer, but whatever.
Plus, you really got to hate the guy's films.
Yeah.
I mean, you really do, to bitch about him as much as we have over the past, like,
that's true.
3 years.
Believe it or not, I actually miss Eli.
He is like the, what would you call him? He's like the...
Eli Roth is currently being shelled right now. I don't know if people know that.
Yeah, it's not as much fun anymore because the one guy that was kind of like our antagonist on this show was completely gone now. I mean, he fell off the face of the earth.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the end of the call-in, or, well, it would be the call-in portion, but it's the end of the fan portion of the show, and we appreciate everybody that sends us these questions and stuff. And, yeah, I think we are going to do the frequently asked questions thing, because that would probably save us a lot of time.
Well, I think that was a pretty detailed explanation of everything that got started, so hopefully that'll help everybody else out that listens to the show.
Yeah, for right now. So we're going to take a break, then we're going to get to some DVD reviews and all that creamy horror goodness here on DeadBit.com.
Hey, folks. This is Jay Reel giving y'all a heads up about Texas Frightmare Weekend. Coming to Dallas, Texas, February 21st through the 24th at the Hilton DFW Lakes in Grapevine. Who's going to be there? George Romero, Malcolm McDowell, D. Wallace Stone. There's going to be a Night of the Living Dead 40th Anniversary World Tour, and, well, there's too much to mention here. Ray Boucher and I are going to be there with a table representing the uber-spectacular DeadPit.com. If all that ain't worth the trip to Texas, then I don't know what is. Look, head to TexasFrightmareWeekend.com for all the info and get busy packing, damn it.
How's everybody feeling?
I'm feeling extra smooth.
Holla. Mm. Yeah, we're back here on DeadPit Radio. That's the end of the fan portion. We didn't have a call-in portion this week.
We didn't, did we?
Before we actually get into the review section of the show, like we normally do, we've got some announcements to make.
Yeah, we've got some extra creepy announcements to make this week on the Dead Pit Show. First being that we have written reviews up. Our good friends Derek Cook, Axelus, J. Real, and more have new reviews up on
Mordecai.
Yeah, Mordecai have new reviews up on the Dead Pit Horror Movie Review Database. It is the most extensive horror movie review database on the entire planet.
Is it really?
It is. Because it covers not only horror DVDs. It goes all the way back to VHS, Laserdisc, even books, horror books, folks. Who the hell reads horror book reviews?
I have no idea.
And we have the newest form of horror home media in HD DVD and Blu-ray discs. We have reviews of both of those up there.
Yeah.
So that's why we're the most extensive. Everyone else can eat my ass.
So let's also talk about something that's near and dear to our heart because it's about us. So that makes it, you know, close to us.
Yeah.
It's the End of the Pit documentary that Kelly Marcotte and Rusty Robot Productions are working on right now. And we've actually got a website up. Tell them about that.
EndOfThePitTheMovie.com is now up. And you can check out the trailer. And this is actually the uncompressed, full-size trailer, which looks fantastic. It looks like a real movie. So you'll definitely have to check that out. Actually, it's the newer version of the trailer, which features Uwe Boll in it.
Oh, yeah. Kevin S. Tenney's in it, too.
Yeah. And John Landis is actually in it as well.
And plus, not only that, but those are the celebrities that are in it. There's tons of Dead Pit fans and just general convention goers and people around our area, too, which is always a goddamn experience.
Yeah, so definitely go to EndOfThePitTheMovie.com and check that out. And hopefully they're going to have a synopsis and all that stuff up soon. And yeah, we're just really excited about that. Of course, you know, it's supposedly coming out in the winter of 2008. So we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing Kelly again, coming back down the US 23 down to Prestonsburg, Kentucky. I'm sure he's excited to death about that.
Yeah. And, you know, possibly in the coming weeks, we'll have more news regarding Dead Pit related stuff at conventions, and there's a lot of stuff that's possibly going to happen. We just need to clear our schedules out, and this could be big news, right, Uncle Bill?
It could be.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Big news for fans that don't live anywhere near Kentucky, we'll just say that. I guess that's it. I think our pin set auction, all that stuff, is up early on Friday, on today. So, if you haven't bid it on it, you better hurry.
Yeah, unless you're planning on being in Texas anytime soon, that'll be the only way you'll be able to get that for ever.
I don't know about forever. But it'll be one of the very few occasions you'll be able to get it when you're not in Texas. So that is that. So let's get on to the DVDs.
I'm really depressed this week. I was going to do.
Why?
Because I wasted a good portion of my week watching this shit.
Oh, you don't need to be like that. Let's talk about Jun Ho Bong's The Host, which is the Blu-ray version that we recently saw from Magnolia Pictures. It's a Korean monster film, right?
This is one that I'd actually heard a ton of stuff about before we even did this review, and I was really looking forward to it, especially because it was the first time I've seen it, but it was in Blu-ray, which would mean the effects would be clear and all that stuff. So it's the story of a guy who works at, I guess it's some kind of like Korean fast food place or something like that.
He works in it looked like a park area that is surrounded by this river in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like he's a vendor there and sells.
Well, he sells food.
Yeah.
It's like a restaurant on the side of rivers.
Yeah, it's not really. It's sort of like, carnival food and stuff, though. It's not really.
Well, I know he sells squid. I don't know what the fuck that is in Korea.
Yeah, that's like corn dog. That's like a corn dog.
Anyway, and he's there with his father and daughter, and I think he has another sister who's like an archer that's trying to win something in the Olympics.
And that comes back in.
Yeah, of course.
The film, of course.
And just one day that he's down there and he's delivering some food, and all of a sudden, first I guess I should start. There's a backstory of a guy working in a morgue. And his boss tells him to dump all of the formaldehyde and all the chemicals and stuff down the drain, which goes into this river.
And pollutes the river, of course, and mutates the animals and stuff. But there was a beginning, in the beginning of this movie, it said it was based on real events. That is actually partially true, because I think it was back in 2000, there was a U.S. citizen that worked, or it was a U.S. Army soldier or something working over there, that was ordered to dump formaldehyde into this specific same river they mentioned in the movie. So that part is actually true, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think what followed is
actually. I don't think that happened as far as the mutated catfish or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah, the thing, okay, so he's out there, fast forward a little bit, he's out there delivering food, and this huge fucking thing just bursts out of this river and starts to rain all kinds of havoc down on all these people that are around laying in this park. And it looks like, literally, like a giant catfish with legs and, like, octopus tentacle things strapped on its back. That's basically what it looks like. And it just goes crazy, and it grabs his daughter and takes her down, and he thinks she's dead. And so the army comes in, quarantines the whole place, and, like, him and his father and sister are all in this quarantine together.
Because, evidently, they're releasing information that the creature is the host of this new virus that is plaguing everyone that touched or was near the creature, right?
Right.
And that's how they got the name The Host.
Right. So, while they're in there, he gets a phone call, and it's from his daughter. So he finds out that she's actually still alive, but he doesn't know where she's at, and she can't tell him all this stuff. So he decides, with the help of his family, to break out of this military base and go on a search to try to find where she's at.
Right.
Well, in the meantime, you find out this thing, this host thing, is capturing all these people. It'll keep them in its jowls, basically, and then kind of regurgitate them down into this little tunnel where they'll all just be kind of like laying around in dead or in comas and all that stuff.
He's hungry enough, I guess.
Like a snack or something like that.
Yeah, and there's some cool stuff in this, too, where actually when he's finished eating the victims, he pukes up all their bones down in that little
that was
area
a cool scene, yeah.
as well. And, there's a lot of cool stuff in this, but there's also a lot of really bad stuff in this. And I don't know if it's partially where it was a Korean film, and, like, some of the stuff they did, like some of the dialogue and just some of the comedy that didn't really work to me. Maybe that's due to, like, a cultural difference from Eastern Kentucky to Korea. But
that's like, a hell of a cultural difference.
Aside from when the creature attacks and just all the scenes of the creature, the movie was sort of, it fell flat aside from that. I mean, I really liked the monster stuff, and I wish there was a lot more of that. And I think that they did a great job. I think Orphanage Inc. is the team that did the work on the monster. And that was awesome. I love that.
See, The thing that I was thinking when I was watching it, though, is that there's probably about, all in all, maybe 10 to 15 minutes that have anything to do with the monster that you get to see. And it's a pretty long movie.
It's a two-hour movie, I think.
So that the fact that the monster does look amazing, and it really does. Like, it's probably one of the better CG monsters you'll ever see in any new film. It does not make up for the fact that the rest of the movie is completely fucking boring. I mean, it is, and it's not very entertaining at all in any sense. Like, the acting's, I guess, good, but and the dubbing's really good, too, is another thing I noticed. I mean, they did a really good job on that, but there's no real story pushing along. After they get out of the military base, it's just basically like a story of them trying to get back to this daughter, but nothing really happens.
Well, and there's something I did sort of like, though, that it was, but of course it revolved around the monster again, was the little girl when she was held captive in the sewer area or whatever, also was befriended by another little boy that the creature captured and stuff. And I like their stuff together. That wasn't a, there wasn't a whole lot of that. But as far as like them trying to escape the monster and the monster was watching them every minute, I liked that a lot. But like the scene with the other family members, a lot of the scenes with the other family members just, they weren't that interesting really to me.
Well, there's a good interplay between the actual live action people and the monster, which is always good. Like, you don't ever really think that it's a CG monster, even though it is completely CG. But yeah, like you were saying, the thing I found to be the worst thing about the film was when they actually get around to talking about the plot about the virus and all this stuff, and you find out what you find out about it. It's I can't figure out why, though. Like, it doesn't really serve any purpose in the story. The story is essentially him trying to get his daughter back, and all the other shit in between is it just kind of goes by the wayside.
I think that they did that, though, because of what happened there at Korea. Like, some of that stuff actually happened. Maybe that was... See, I think a lot of it is a cultural difference between people here and the country of Korea. People live over there. They would get a lot more of that stuff than we would, really.
That might be true, but I'm telling you, like, dull as fuck crosses all cultural boundaries, and that's what the film is when it's not dealing with the monster. I mean, yeah. It really is.
Overall, though, I mean, I thought it was okay. I didn't hate the movie, but, like, you know, like he said, it's not, to me, it's not up there at like Cloverfield level. I like Cloverfield a lot better than The Host.
I know a lot of people like to compare that movie to Cloverfield for some reason. I guess because just the monsters in it. But to me, Cloverfield would win that hands down. Yeah, there's not even really competition.
Yep.
I was disappointed in the film, though. I'd heard so many good things about it. It's got an amazing amount of positive feedback, but it didn't have anything to do with the hype surrounding it. Even if I hadn't heard about the film, I still think exactly the same thing I do about it now.
But even that, I mean, I still think it's one of the better Asian horror movies we've ever seen.
God, that would be a sad statement on the state of Asian horror.
It's true, though. I mean, wouldn't you say that?
Well,
it's one of them, at least.
The thing that saves that movie is the CG effects and the way that monster was constructed. That's really what saves it. There's nothing else, to me, there's nothing else going for that movie. And does that make an entire film good? That's up for people to decide, I guess.
Yeah. But the Blu-ray edition of the movie was pretty good. I mean, the picture quality was awesome, as always. And I know it had lossless sound, which I still don't have the stuff properly hooked up, so we couldn't enjoy that.
The dubbing.
No. Well, but the weird thing about that DVD or that Blu-ray disc is, of all the amounts of audio track, I think there's total of like 8 different audio tracks on it because it has DTS and DTS, Dolby Digital, and PCM lossless, which is like the top of line now, supposedly, in the Blu-ray. All those in both English and Korean, so that's 6. Then you have like a separate two separate commentary tracks, I think. So that's a lot of stuff on just a lot of room taken up that. And they have a lot of extras and all that stuff, too. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive Blu-ray disc, and it was pretty cool. I mean, the disc itself was cool. It looked cool to me.
I pretty much say one thing about it, though. I did kind of like the ending, even though you can see that ending coming a mile away. Like, I think I said at the beginning of the film that it was going to come down to that, and it, of course, did. Yeah. But the way that it was filmed was really good is what I'm saying.
Yep, so that's The Host from Magnolia Pictures. It's one of their very first releases on Blu-ray. So, yeah, definitely check it out if you're into that sort of stuff. I think if you're into the Asian films, like, I think...
If you're a big fan of Godzilla, you probably like that film, or any of those movies of that nature.
Although it's a great update for that. I mean, modern, you know, he definitely won't say it's the hokey Godzilla stuff.
No, so, it's just a monster film, though.
So let's go on. That's that was The Host again by Jung Hong Bong. We got.
Well, let's talk about this one real quick. Can't Stop the Rock screener.
You can't stop the rock. Can't stop what you can't stop the rock
when it feels
can't
you.
Can't stop the rock.
Anyway. 2007 from Marquee Motion Pictures. This is, it's not a documentary. That's what I'd like to call it because that's kind of what it's supposed to be. But it's only, a documentary normally has things in it where you follow people around and see what they're doing. This is just an interview with a guy in a hotel room. The guy is, of course, Dave The Rock Nelson, who is a bit of a cult icon, especially around convention circuits, because he has a string of really bad Ed Wood-ish type of films.
I think someone coined the phrase, he's the Ed Wood of the 90s.
Right. We're talking about stuff like, I've got a list here, Demon Monster from Outer Space, Devil Ant, Frankenstein Stalks, Miss Werewolf, Monster Tales, Mummy A.D., The Pumpkin Man Saga, Conrad Brooks versus the Werewolf, and my personal favorite, Frankenstein versus Saddam Insane.
And what's interesting about this guy's films is he, I don't know if still, but I mean up to when they were filming the documentary, he pretty much edited everything on a VCR.
Yeah.
And it was really old school. He doesn't work with computers hardly at all. And
I didn't think at this time he had a DVD player, like a DVD recorder.
Yeah, DVD recorder. So I thought that was pretty interesting that this day and time. And all of his movies are still just on VHS. You know, he doesn't have any of them transferred to DVD. And the guy is like a very, I don't know if you would say.
He's like Toby Ratliff on Crystal Meth.
Yeah, I mean, he's a way more outgoing Toby Ratliff sort of character.
Everybody in their lives knows somebody like that. You get them started talking, and you cannot interrupt them. Like, you can't even get enough time in to ask a question. I felt so sorry for the guy. There's, like, one guy that's trying to ask questions and stuff.
I think he asked maybe two questions.
Yeah. It's just, like, a constant stream of information where it gets to the point where you're sitting there watching it, and you're like, Jesus Christ, I just wish he'd take a break for a minute and let somebody else talk.
And it's one of those deals, too, where this guy will talk about a certain topic.
Yeah.
Then he'll go to something else and come back to that topic 10 minutes later and finish it up.
And, of course, the subject of the documentary is this guy's life, you know, this Dave Nelson guy.
And they actually do have snippets from some of his movies. And see what this guy does to get cameos from these guys.
This is pretty hilarious.
Is walk up to him at a convention where they're sitting at a table. Like, I know there was one with Forrest Ackerman that he did.
Tom Savini was another one.
Tom Savini was another one where, like, he was making the movie The Devil Spider. Or what was it called?
I don't know. There's Devil Ant.
Devil Ant, yeah. That's what it was. The Devil Ant, where he would just walk around to people and have the little plastic Devil Ant thing in the corner of the screen and hold it and throw it at people. And that's how he would get them in the movie.
Yeah, essentially he'd walk up to somebody and say, I'm making this movie. Would you mind if I threw this fucking rubber ant at you?
Yeah.
And you react to it. And then if they said yes, he'd put it in the movie.
Yeah.
That would be it.
I mean, that's the movie for you. You know, that's how he gets his cameos.
The Conrad Brooks one, Conrad Brooks versus the Werewolf. I think he actually did get Conrad Brooks to do the acting in it where he's fist fighting like a guy in a werewolf outfit.
Right.
But seriously, this is like the stuff that I saw that they had, the clips, stuff, it looked literally like if you were to put on like a werewolf, Frankenstein, Dracula mask, whatever, go out into the woods somewhere and invite somebody else, you know, something else, or invite somebody else, and you just kill them, or you box them, or there was nothing else to it that I could see. There might be a great story involved in there, but that wasn't what it was portrayed as in this film, really.
Yeah, I just kept watching it and kept trying to think exactly what the point is.
the guy,
other than promoting the guy, and I'm sure the guys that made this from Marquee Motion Pictures, they really like, you know, Dave Nelson, and just think he's fun, and he is pretty funny. But it, after about the movie lasts close to an hour, I think.
Mm-hmm.
After about the 20-30 minute mark, It was just really...
It's hard to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it was getting pretty old, and I think that there needed to be something else to it other than...
Because...
Yeah, I just talk. And I think, honestly, that it would almost get old with anybody.
That's what I was going to say, because if you were to come in here and sit down with me and say, you know, I need to fill up this documentary, we need to talk about all the stuff that you've done, it's just like after a while of continuously talking like he does, he runs back into the same stories, and yeah. then he tells them again the exact same way.
And
nobody really wants to see that I can imagine with anybody.
And it's clear that the guy's a huge fan of the genre.
Yeah, he's a huge fan of wrestling, too, which is odd.
Yeah, how proud he is of, you know, getting some certain autographs from people. And he's like, oh, I got so-and-so's autograph, you know, and I got them in my movie Devil Ant. He's really excited about the genre, and it's not a knock on him or anything. It's always great to see people that are, you know, that have that deep love for the horror genre and for monster movies and all that stuff. But this movie in particular, like, I don't even know if it was a movie. I don't even know what it was. I mean, it was sort of entertaining.
It seemed like an afternoon that you would do with friends or something. It doesn't really seem like it should be turned into a movie. But the guy, I mean, like I said, he's a cult icon to a lot of people, especially around Chicago, which is where he's from, and especially on convention circuits. Overall, though, the majority of the stuff that he talks about, it has to do with his films, which I have a tendency to think that his life story would probably have been a lot more interesting than these films, because the guy was actually, he was in the Navy, I think, or the Marines.
Yeah.
He was a boxer. He was like a pretty well-renowned boxer at that stage in time, and he tells all that stuff, of course, in this, too. But you just, at some point, I wish to God somebody on this film would have edited some shit.
Yeah. Like, seems like a guy, yeah, I mean, you could have probably got a lot of good stuff if you would have just edited the, you know, edited it better, and it was, I don't know, it was, I think it's too much to ask for the common horror fan to watch this movie and actually enjoy it. And I wish those guys best of luck and stuff, and I don't even remember, I'm guessing through MySpace we got this. And,
What was it? It was, MySpace.com/CantStopTheRockNelson or something like that.
Yeah, I think that was the MySpace page. So check that out if you want to. We appreciate the guy sending the stuff to review, and best of luck.
Yeah, if you know this guy or if you've heard of him or familiar with his work, this would probably be worthwhile to own. It's just, like he said, it's a bit too long and arduous to try to get through.
A bit much, yeah. I think. Let's talk about something that really didn't wear out its welcome at all. It's actually one of my favorite, probably my favorite film of the week. And it's not even a feature-length film. It's a 46-minute short film called Hatchet Jack.
Hatchet Jack, he lives alone in the back. Hatchet Jack, gonna crack you in the sack. Hatchet Jack. Oh, Hatchet Jack.
We got a song for every... movie this week.
This one was actually, like, I knew from the very beginning of it that I would probably like it no matter what, because the simple reason that it takes place in West Virginia, and anybody that has, like, any intent to play up West Virginia's notoriety and past, I always love it. I don't give a damn what it is.
Hatchet Jack is essentially what Hatchet should have been. It's pretty much the legend of Hatchet Jack, which is just a basic woodland killer, pretty much, like the classic slasher films of the 80s. And a group of, I think that they, most of the story is a flashback where these guys at a bar are telling the story of a group of teenagers back in the early 90s, I don't remember what year, 91, 92, something like that, go for a weekend of partying as well as to discover the home of Hatchet Jack, or, you know, visit the resting place of Hatchet Jack or something like that. And, of course, you know, they get more than they bargained for. They actually get to meet Hatchet Jack get to be murdered by the man.
And the guy's name that directed it's Eddie Mihalik. I think that's how you pronounce it, Eddie Mihalik. It's based supposedly on a true story that happened in Washington County, Pennsylvania. And they just transplanted it to West Virginia because I guess they imagine West Virginia, all kinds of bad shit happens,
oh, yeah.
Which is true. The one thing I really, really liked about this film was the beginning is a great setup for one thing. They did a good job with that. It's like most slasher films where they're around telling a story, except it's not a campfire this time. It's around like a bar. The other thing was the guy was not afraid to experiment with the camera techniques. You see a lot of stuff in this film that is completely unique. Like, for instance, if people are walking, he'll move them forward, like with a real quick edit kind of cut thing. And he used a lot of, like when Hatchet Jack's actually doing the killing, he used a lot of the weird editing techniques and stuff. Just different shots, different angles, different ways to film things that don't necessarily always, well, actually don't rarely ever happen in independent slasher films, I guess.
Yeah, I just thought it was an overall fun movie. The only gripe I would have is when you actually do get to see Hatchet Jack, you don't really get to see him. I mean, it's so quick, and the killings are so quick that, you know, the majority of the movie was the build-up. And then maybe the last 5 minutes, if that, was the kill scenes. And that was a little quick. But overall, I enjoyed the movie. I mean, it was, like I said, it was one of my favorite films that we reviewed this week.
Another thing that, you can tell these guys don't have a lot of money, and they pretty much did this, you know, as independent as it comes and as low budget as it comes. But there's one scene where they kind of flash back to all the murders and stuff during the middle of the film. And then at the end, they kind of go back to that, and they use the same props that they used in the middle of the film to flash back to it at the end, too. So you've kind of already blown your wad, so to speak, by the time you get to the end of the film.
Right.
And they've used all the prosthetics and shit that they bought. It looks like they bought some just limbs and stuff like that to have around for the kill scenes. So,
for what they put into it, though, I mean, I thought it was a bang up job. I enjoyed the movie. Hatchet Jack's off the chain.
Yeah, it's probably a lot better than what we could do if you just gave us like a bunch of shit and threw us out in the woods somewhere.
Oh, I know it's a lot better than what we could do. We'd be lucky if we could find a woman to have all her teeth. Let alone show a woman's got tits, like nice tits.
Yeah, that's true.
So.
So I guess that's Hatchet Jack.
That's Hatchet Jack.
If you, I'm trying to remember what the
Hatchet
hell
load of fun.
Has it got the MySpace page on there anywhere?
It's got HJ on it. And it's got Hatchet Jack. It's got.
Thank you for reading that.
NTSC. Uh-huh. And it's got the runtime 46 minutes and 15 seconds.
I'm trying to think. I know they have a MySpace page. Just go in and search for Hatchet Jack. I'm pretty sure it'll come up. It might just even be / Hatchet Jack.
Yeah. So I enjoyed the movie. I thought it was good. So
everybody, thank you, Eddie Mihalik. We appreciate
everybody,
it.
Everybody go out and check that one out.
So up next, another luscious film that I've been waiting to talk about. It's Goth Kill, The Soul Collector.
Yeah, and it's the one movie of our Mistress Julia double feature, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
First movie, I guess.
From Maximum Restraint Films Incorporated. That's a hell of a name. Directed by J.J. Conley.
It's your buddy J.J. who
Dynamite.
Just been talking to me on MySpace recently, so I figured we could give this movie a review.
Okay. So start at the beginning, I guess, is that what I say, the best place to start. Catholic priest and inquisitor, all around initially a good guy. His name's Nick Dredd, I think. Nicholas Dredd.
Nicky.
It was, I guess, during the time when they were burning all the people at the stake and the witchcraft, the Salem witch trials and all that stuff. Initially, he was with the church, and he was burning all these people at the stake. And he decided to do something about it because he was happy with the fact that he wasn't sure if these people were actually witches or not, and these other priests were giving him this rigmarole. He didn't really understand why they were doing it. So he tells them this stuff. They decide to burn him at the stake because he questions them and all this stuff. So as he dies and curses them on the... While he's being burned,
they burn him
at
the stake too.
Right, so he vowed he would have his revenge.
Poor Nick Dredd.
So you fast forward to the 21st century, and it's in New York, and he's like a cult leader, and he gets all these people together and kills all of them to get himself purposely arrested and executed, because he knows after he's been executed that this he's going to be resurrected. Right. So there's this book I guess it's one of his minions or followers, whatever, brings to him in his jail cell, and they read this incantation. It's supposed to bring him back to life, whatever. On her way home, taking it back home, she gets, this is really weird, like turn of events, gets hit by a car.
Yeah.
This black guy steals the book, runs out and sells it in the middle of the street.
It's a homeless black guy.
Yeah. He sells it in the middle of the street to this guy who owns this club called the Scorpion, Scorpion Society.
Yeah, it's pretty much a, just a gothic vampire club or something.
Right, all these goth people are in there. They're not real goth vampires. They just
basically, they're posers like the majority of the goth vampires out there.
What they're basically doing is they get all these people in there and sell them a big line, and then they get money off of them, and they keep this club running and stuff. So this guy gets this book. He thinks it's a fake book, and he's just going to try to impress everybody by drugging this woman up that's at this club, who actually happens to be a very nice virgin-like woman. He drugs her and does this spell on her. As it turns out,
sticks a finger up her butt.
Yeah, he sticks a finger up her butt. As it turns out, the book actually works, and it's the same book that he used to, going to raise himself from the dead. So when he does this on this woman, she becomes possessed by this guy's soul that's in hell. So she turns into him and basically causes complete fucking havoc on this club and kills most everybody and all this stuff.
And it's like a killing spree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't that good.
Oh, whatever. Look, I'll give the guy credit for actually doing a movie that I don't even know if I've seen a movie like this. I mean, this is a pretty inventive idea for a film, I'll say that.
Yeah, it's not often you see a demonic possession movie anymore.
Not in that style.
Let me tell you something. No! I ain't gonna have it!
You what?
I ain't gonna have it!
Why not?
Okay. Here, let's just go through this because I don't want to be a dick about it. The good points first. It's actually pretty good production quality and stuff for an independent film. He actually got some decent sets and stuff like that.
Mistress Julia's in it. Well, here's one thing I was mad at, though. Like, Nick Dredd, when he's in hell, he's got two of the devil bitches with him who are painted completely red.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is completely nude, and the other is Mistress Julia, who has like a bra on.
I know. That sucks.
That's bullshit.
That's false advertising. Yeah. Okay, some of the bad things about it. It, for one thing, it's 70 minutes long, which means that they didn't have a lot of time for a story, which is pretty evident, because it just, everything happens one thing right after another. Although I do like the guy that plays the Nicholas Dredd character, and he kind of pops up at weird times and gives you like some weird ass narration about what's going on, kind of like an avant-garde kind of way.
The thing I was watching though and notice is that it seems to me like a modern midnight movie. It would be something good for a midnight movie. It's just a bizarre, a lot of one-liners and stuff like that in it. And it's just shot like it's, the way it's shot's like very colorful, long lines, even like Rocky Horror Picture Show or something. I don't even know if that probably wasn't an influence or anything, but it just reminded me of the filming of that movie, the way it looked.
And it's kind of weird though, because at the beginning of it, it's very artistic film. It does a lot of interesting cut scenes where it'll flashback to other time periods and flashback to places that are supposed to be hell and all this stuff. But then at the end, like, it completely goes against everything that it did before that and just turns into a really lame slasher film. I guess that's my worst problem with it. It doesn't really show anything, and it's just a series of this guy going around a club killing people for, with no real cuss for about 5 minutes. That's all it is. Which, yeah, it seems to me like you built up this film all the way to an ending that really was even worse than all the stuff that you did before, which I don't really understand why you do that.
Yeah, but I have no idea how many other films this guy has done, but the technical aspects of it, I think that he pulled off a pretty decent movie, looking wise and stuff. But I think this type of movie is for a select group of people. I don't know if this type of movie is for us.
I mean, would it be for a goth group of people?
Yeah, I think it would be more for, like, people into that culture,
I can buy that. But if you're going to sell things just strictly to goths, you're not going to make very much money. I mean, that's a very small subgenre of people. But anyway, the special features.
It had its own style, though. I mean,
I'm not going to deny that the guy has probably got a lot of promise as a filmmaker and stuff. It's just I didn't get anything out of this movie, and I thought that the way that it was wrapped up, it could have been done a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not definitely not perfect, but we appreciate the well, give us some info about the movie.
Let's see. You've got Maximum Restraint Films, of course, is the company that this guy owns. Special features, a theatrical trailer. There's a director's commentary, which even I think this guy says something to the effect of it's commentary like the Mystery Science Theater commentaries or something, where I guess they talk shit about the film or something. Production photos, interactive menu, and full motion chapters. It doesn't seem to be a website on here, although I do remember that this film does have a website. I don't know.
Yeah, just golfkillthesoulcollector.com or something.
Yeah, there ain't shit on here.
Yeah, it'd probably be a good idea for all the independent filmmakers out there to put your website on the DVD, just so we can, like, mention it on the show.
It's always a good tip.
So that's Golf Kill, the Soul Collector.
I'm sure you can go back and put that shit in there anyway.
Put what shit in there?
Just a little website. I ain't gonna put shit in there. I won't do it.
Yeah, you can. You can do it.
Up next is Punk's Not Dead. It's just lost its head. It's Punk Rock Holocaust 2.
Ah! There.
This one also has Mistress Yuri in it. And she doesn't get naked in this one either.
Big surprise.
God damn it.
Although this is more like classic Mistress Julie, where she does those little updates from the, like she did when she was with Fuse.
Did you see the episode that she did of, what was it called? Uranium or something like
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
And she's shitting this plastic bag and dumped it on some guy's head or something.
No.
That was my favorite episode ever, but.
That's a good idea, though. I'm going to shit on a plastic bag and dump it on your head.
No.
Okay. This is directed by old Douglas Sackman. And
Dougie.
It takes place during the Vans Warped Tour, I think 2004, I want to say. I think that's what somebody says in the film.
Yeah, I think that it's a sequel because the first movie was in 2004, and that was actually on. I think they sort of just edited it to make it seem like that was in 2004 as well.
So, Lord, where do I even start with this? It follows around a group of, are they reporters that are trying to figure out
what happened
at the original Punk Rock Holocaust Fest.
Yeah. Which we've never even seen that one.
It's weird that you'd have to know the original film of this to get everything that goes on in Punk Rock Holocaust 2.
Right.
But essentially what it is they're going around to all these different people trying to figure out what happened with the original Punk Rock Holocaust, and that gives the filmmakers this one time to throw in all these people with the Vans Warped Tour, all these different bands and stuff, which I guess some of them are probably listed on the DVD as some of the bands that played there.
A lot of bands that sound really shitty to me.
Well, they're bands that we don't necessarily like, I guess, but I'm sure they've got their place. And even, I think she says at the beginning of it, Mistress Julia says she's not a big fan of that type of music either. She's more like an Ozfest type of person.
Which, that completely threw me off. Like, why? The people that make this are actually behind the band Warped Tour. Why would they even mention Ozfest?
True.
Anyway,
I don't know.
Yeah, but the whole thing, though, the killer from, I guess, the first movie is back, but he doesn't have his head. So he's looking for his head. And this actually is a good way to have different cameos in the movie because the people, like, he rips various people's heads off and puts their head on.
Right.
And that, you know, I don't know who any of these people are, really. But, and that's where the cameos come in, really, is who they kill in the movie, and who the headless dude kills.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, you can tell that this was more of a vehicle for all these bands than it was to actually make a movie about it, because they don't really spend a whole lot of time or editing on anything that has to do with kill scenes or the story or anything like that. It's just an excuse for them to move into different places, show different bands, and have some of these people have cameos. And the one thing that I did notice, that I kind of really didn't like because it was just kind of problematic of being lazy is that the guy that runs the Vans Warped Tour, I'm trying to remember his name, Kevin Lyman, yeah, is they give him lines and stuff in this movie because he's supposed to be the trying to figure out what's going on because it's his, you know, festival or tour or whatever. And I swear to God, like, every line they give him, he just sits there and reads it directly off the paper while looking down at it in front of the camera. It's like there's no effort at all put into any kind of you know, acting or trying to act like you're not reading shit off of the script and all that stuff. It's like they found the guy in a control room and just threw a script at him and said, read all this stuff off or put it in this movie, which I'm sure they did.
I'll say this about this. I mean, this is an ingenious idea for the people from the Vans Warped Tour to allow this because it's pretty much a promotional vehicle for that tour. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
And it mixes music from the people that were there performing the music. It sounded horrible to me. It sounded fucking awful. It's not my type of music, but whatever.
And I kind of like some of the stuff. I didn't like any of the bands people probably know, though.
Mixes. I didn't like any of it. I listened. Well, I watched the whole movie. I didn't like a goddamn thing.
Yeah, which can be expected. I mean.
It mixes, though. I mean, it gives some concert footage. Then you actually cut from that into a horror movie. And it's a pretty cool idea. But the way they did it, I don't know. I didn't think it, I didn't like it, really.
Yeah, technically they could have just made a straight up concert film if they wanted to promote that bad. I don't know what the appeal was to make a horror film.
It has some good gore stuff in it, some funny stuff. But I think it was just the punk rock stuff that I didn't like. Like, I don't know. I just didn't know any of the bands. Maybe if it was bands that I actually knew and music I actually liked, I might have actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is. It's kind of like a trauma film in a lot of ways. And even
Lloyd Kaufman's in it. Big surprise.
Lloyd Kaufman plays the devil in it, or this guy named Belial, who's basically...
I'm surprised he gets sued.
Yeah, who's basically in charge of... Lyman, who's is supposed to be some kind of minstrel, what do you call him? Minstrel. He plays the flute for the devil. No, yeah. He's a minion of this of the devil, who's played by Lloyd Kaufman, who's purposely trying to cause all these people to get killed, I guess, because he works for the devil. And it's for those cameos that Lloyd Kaufman always does, where he does them from his office, and you can tell.
Yeah.
So that's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, I think some people would like this though. If you're into that type of music, then this is more your bag. You know, I mean, I'm not honestly like I don't think I'm that picky when it comes to music, but this type of stuff, like I don't like punk music anyway. I especially don't like newer punk music.
That's true.
Like, that's some of the horrible. Like there was some female band. That was some of the god awful horrible shit to listen to.
Well, let's talk about the god awful horrible shit. Let's name the bands that are on here real quick.
Okay, give them shout outs.
Yeah, the Casualties, the Aquabats, My Chemical Romance, which a lot of people know. It's probably my least favorite band on here. Bouncing Souls, Mr. Dibs, and of course, you know, Metal VJ Mistress Julia.
And Mr. Pibb.
Also. I think there's also a couple other people on here. The Planet Smashers, Riverboat Gamblers, River City Rebels. Wasn't the River City Rebels in a Nintendo game? Wasn't that like a...
Bay City Rollers?
No.
Are they going to be here?
Anyway, She-Ra Girl, I think, is the band you're talking about that had the...
She-Ra Girl?
Yeah, She-Ra Girl or She-Ra Girl or something to that effect. Sugar Cult and the Teenage Harlots.
They're definitely not the Princesses of Power.
No, they're not.
What about the Dick Holes? Are they going
to... No, the Dick Holes or Maggot Farts aren't in this.
Fuck.
See, that's what I was thinking. I was watching, like, how cool it would be if they actually did a film like this, but had metal bands in it, which I think would, for us anyway, would probably be a lot better premise.
Yeah. Metal Holocaust.
But yeah, if you're a fan of these bands,
maybe
this,
Ozzy could put that on, like for Ozfest.
This definitely would be something to get, though. It comes with a commentary with the director, alternate film score performed by Hick, Nick, and Jew of the Dead.
Oh Lord, go there.
The long-awaited Ketchup versus Mustard Ultimate Condiment Race, and a She-Ra Girl music video, which I know you probably watched and loved. It's like Bobcat Goldthwait singing.
Yeah.
That's
punk, though, man. It's like
hard. Go over to Halo8.tv or PunkRockHolocaust.com to check this out. If you're a fan of this type of music, you can't go wrong with a... you know,
horror punk.
Film, punk.
Shit.
Yeah, hybrid. Yeah. So I guess that's
it. Punk, they would have had the Ramones in it, but they're already dead anyway.
That'd be a real resurrection right there.
Can't kill them again, unfortunately.
Shut up.
So, I guess that's it for this week. Next week, of course, Eric Stanzi, Part 2, Electric Boogaloo, is next week's show. And we're going to return to the phone calls, right?
Return of the Phone Calls tonight.
Yeah. So, until then, I'm the Creepy Dougie.
And I'm Uncle Bill. And
you've been listening to the first, and people always say it's the best, horror talk radio show, Deadbit.com.
Bang it.
Just like the wide-winged dove sings a song, sounds like she's singing.